If you're interested in legends, I've got something to show you. It was a legend that brought me to Esperanza in the first place. A legendary treasure on the bottom of the sea. I found all these statues in deep water just off that point. Everyone has been in this seaport down through the ages. It's been one of the crossroads of the world for more than 20 centuries. Greeks, Romans, Moors, and even the mysterious Celts who dragged those stones up to the cliff where your car went over, Stephen. This is Phoenician. It antedates those statues by 1,000 years. Ancient peoples travelled far greater distances than is generally supposed. We've always known the Phoenicians were on this coast, but this is a rare find because of the inscription. The text on this tablet corroborates a passage in the Bible from the Book of Kings, which has hitherto been regarded as pure legend. Never dismiss the legends, Pandora.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 26th of September 2025. Streaming live, yes, live, from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say, but do try to share moments of clarity. That's what we do from Bristol's Templar Port. That's where it all started back in medieval times, and the medieval institution called the Merchant Venturers that was behind the genocide of 100 million, yes, look it up, 100 million Native Americans. They are still running the show here in Bristol. It's a little merchant venture of fiefdom, really, in the City of London's Empire of Lies, otherwise known as Great Britain. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from GitHub. Best place to get it, links on the show page, thisweek.org.uk, also from APK Pure, or the Apple App Store, it's called the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. But you won't get it from evil Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero-trust agenda psyops with a few little drips of truth, occasionally managing to squeeze their way in there just to make it sound credible, and bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities. Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, the witch hunts going after everyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentier class, World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to these multiplying crises, housing, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the twisted accelerationist Armageddonist solutions in the highest levels of political parties and the press, crafted to make every crisis worse. Have the cabinet sold their souls to the devil because the politicians no longer have anything to say? Or even the opposition, eh? Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment, Social Darwinist Control Freaks and Cowardly Underlings want us as slaves to their AI, or maybe just dead. Albert Pike's World War III plan is a big taboo. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie, you know him, and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. Just imagine if Diana was still around and Carmilla had been elbowed out. Imagine that. Imagine that. Anyone who's not their mates is the ones that they are waging war on. The Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, and the only right they want us to have is our so-called right to kill ourselves. With their help, like with those nasty jabs, a bit more on that tonight, of a doctor. Netanyahu's the king of chaos, rolling out a blood red carpet for the Zionist man-god messiah to come, but it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich, it's Irish Republican Labour activist, lovely to have him back, Martin Summers. Dr Chris Busby and Marianne Birkby from Radiation Free Lakeland interviewed tonight because all sorts going on up there. They want to dig a great big hole. They've been wanting to do this for decades and just bury a load of low-level waste. Well, now, what marvellous Millibrain has decided to do is to bury the high-level waste instead. And there's all sorts of reasons why that is just ridiculous, insane, not environmental by a bit. And we're a friend to the earth. Oh, well, they were celebrating the extension of the life of the nuclear power stations in Scotland. Well, a wonderful thing, because the nuclear is so much better than coal. Oh, friends of the earth, wakey wakey. Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and from People's Republic of Stokescroft by the Trans Lobby, but not cancelled from here yet. So also, Martin, a biggie this week, I suppose, is the United Nations General Assembly, from which the Palestinians have been excluded in New York by Trump not letting them have their visas. When Netanyahu was giving his speech earlier today to the world, actually the world all walked out.
Well,
pretty much, apart from the Americans.
Hardly surprising, is it, given the circumstances? Well, I mean, you know, Netanyahu had to fly, not to overfly France when he was going there, because the possibility was that if he overflew France, he might be arrested under the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction. So the Palestinians are not allowed to go to New York because Trump won't let them. Netanyahu is, but he can't go the quickest way because he might be arrested on the way. So here we all are.
So we'll be looking at Ukraine and Gaza, particularly after the break. But also, I think in the run-up to the break, we're going to be hearing some from the UN, because I'm just disgusted. I hear on the news bits and pieces of Trump's speech. I hear GB News broadcasting the whole of Netanyahu's speech. But there's all sorts of people who have been speaking there we're not hearing at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, what happens with the UN is we hear the stuff that our masters want us to hear, and lots of other things we're not going to hear because they don't want us to hear it. Although, of course, it's all on the record and people around the world are listening to it. We're not allowed to hear it.
I'd just like to start out, though, tonight with a quite a good story. Well, it's definitely a good news story. It's about the first community-owned farm in Britain. It's to double in size after another farm was donated. Now, I've been following this stuff for quite a while, which is to do with something called the Countryside Restoration Trust, which was started by a guy called Robin Page, a fantastic journalist. And he used to live up in Norfolk, and he was the guy who used to do One Man and His Dog, and he was a writer about the post-war countryside and the invasion from the cities for many years. And his charity was called the Countryside Restoration Trust. The idea here is what you do is you just farm in old-fashioned ways, and then you can look after the environment. So you're not using pesticides, anything like that. Yes, a bit of fertilizer, but not loads. And the idea is that you lose a lot of the fertilizer that you're using is actually generated on the farm. That was his way. So, for example, manure from animals, from horses, using horsepower rather than tractor power. These are the sorts of things that Robin was encouraging. Anyway, his charity, lots of people donated their farms to the charity over the years in terms of bequests. So rather than have the farm broken up through inheritance tax or whatever, they would donate it whilst they were still alive, to the trust. That was then taken over, and it's vile what they've done to it. They've changed the name of it. They've also got rid of that ethos completely, and Robin has been airbrushed out of history pretty much. They have this sort of page about him on there where they say what a wonderful guy he was, but they killed him, basically. That's what some of the commentators said, that he died of a broken heart when his charity... He had a trust, and there were various people who he trusted, he put on the board, and they voted him off the board. So, so it's good to see that up in Shropshire something different is happening. With this farm in North Shropshire, became the first in the country to be community owned, is set to double in size. So I'll put a little link up to that. And if you're ever up in Shropshire, obviously it's a great place to go. It's called Ford Hall Organic Farm near Market Drayton. And so something similar seems to be happening. And this is one of the things the farmers, I think, really do need to figure out, is how to make sure that they're not losing farms through inheritance tax, and the families are managing to hang on to them, or at least hang on to control of trusts like this that are able to run the farms in a... what do you make of the whole sort of farmer agenda?
Well, I mean, the farmer agenda is extremely vague, isn't it? I mean, if you say the farmer agenda, what farmers are we talking about? Agricultural policy is obviously a big issue all over the world, not just in this country.
What about here, though?
Well, here, what's happened is with the Common Agricultural Policy, when we went into the EU, we have subsidised farming. The US subsidises its farmers, and so do we. Of course, that causes big problems for developing countries, because they can't afford to subsidise their farmers, but they're forced to open their markets to the subsidised stuff that the EU, Britain and the US dumps on them. Now, ultimately, of course, that is not fair. And, of course, in many countries, farming, like in India, is far more important than it is in this country. And, you know, most of the population are directly dependent on farming, which is one of the reasons why Modi hasn't agreed to cut... Trump has been saying they want to dump US agricultural stuff on the Indians. And this has been a big problem in all the trade negotiations. Not that trade negotiations happen now, because the WTO has been smashed by Trump. The farmers in India, who, if you remember, rebelled very strongly a couple of years ago, Greta Thunberg gave them some support. They are the big stumbling block to the liberalisation of international agricultural trade. And the Americans don't like it, but there's not a lot they can do about it. The Indians are never going to sacrifice their farmers, because that's most of the population. Now, of course, that's far more important to them than farming is to us in this country. It's a minority race. That's a minority pursuit in this country.
Yeah. Is it a good idea if companies, corporations own and control farms? They say it's much more efficient than families, and families are inefficient.
Well, I believe that we should nationalise the land, Tony, and then you could rent it out to all sorts of different people.
Well, but you've just taken, sort of leapt over the question I'm asking you, which is the best? Is it better to have companies managing land or individuals, families?
Well, in Russia, it's all run, modern Russia, it's all run by not cooperatives, but great big concerns, because it's very flat, you see? So it makes a lot of sense to have big farms with lots of machinery. In Switzerland, on the other hand, because it's very steep, that's not going to work. So all of these things are to bear in mind when you're talking about agricultural policy in any country.
It's not really just to do with the flatness of the land, though, surely. I mean, whole counties here, like Norfolk, are pretty flat. It doesn't mean to say that only one type of ownership is appropriate. It seems to me it's a bit like our high streets, that it's much better to have these businesses in the hands of families, and it gives them a living too.
Well, in developing countries like Brazil, the Movimento Sem Terras, the movement of the landless, is attempting to try and create subsistence farming on disused land, which is owned by the latifundisti, who are the big landowners. But they don't like that, because it challenges them. So that ends up as a political conflict, including killings. And of course, in Nicaragua, as we've mentioned before, they had a revolution where thousands and thousands of people died. It was an armed struggle, and they gave the land to the peasants.
Actually, in South Africa, it's a big issue right now.
It is a big issue in South Africa. 70% of the land in South Africa is owned by a tiny proportion of the population, the white population. Of course, they got it by force. Now, they got it by force. They didn't buy it. They took it at gunpoint. Now, of course, if any attempt to try and take it back off them...
Didn't our own big feudal landowners here do exactly the same?
Well,
the big estates.
What they did is that when William the Conqueror when William the Conqueror turned up, you've got an existing peasant class which are subordinated to the existing ruling class, and they just took it over as a going concern. Ultimately, of course, there was enclosure. The beneficiaries of enclosure in this country are the ancestors of the current farmers, and they were the ones who enclosed the land and pushed everybody else off and into the factories.
Well, yeah.
So that land used to belong to everybody, Tony, and now it belongs to their families.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because actually it's been a lot easier. Many of the families that own farms now have got, over the last 100 years or so, have bought farms because the land was much cheaper than it is now.
Well, it was cheaper at one stage because British farming was actually very inefficient.
And
been inefficient since the 1880s.
Every county had its county farm. So if you wanted to get started in farming, you just rent a cheap county farm with 150 acres or so, and that can start giving you a foothold. But I think the idea was, rather than the ordinary family farmers keeping this in their families for hundreds and hundreds of years, is that it was just seen as another thing that people did, another business that they whether it's a high street shop or a small factory or whatever that a family could set up. Anyway, recently we had a discussion in the House of Commons with someone called David Chadwick MP, questioned by the DEFRA, is questioning the DEFRA minister, Daniel Zeichner MP. Now, this Daniel Zeichner is very much detested by the farmers. They feel like he's just basically out to get them in this country.
Prior to the announcement of these inheritance tax reforms, What specific discussions or consultations did your department engage in with Treasury officials regarding the potential impact of the reforms?
Well, as you all know, budgets are very much the responsibility of Her Majesty's Treasury. What I would say is that this, although it obviously came as a shock to some, this issue had been discussed over many, many years. And I had been lobbied by a number of groups 2-3 years prior to the election on these issues. And actually, going back through issues, as I do sometimes, old issues of Farmers Weekly, I couldn't help noticing long before the budget, there were advisers saying it would be sensible for people to think about the possibilities of change, because change was almost inevitable at some point in the future. So while I absolutely accept that people are anxious about this, what I would want to say is I would reassure most people that they will not be affected by it.
And to what extent do you believe that the UK government adequately acknowledged and addressed the concerns of farmers in Wales, both prior to and following the announcement of the inheritance tax reforms in October 2024?
What I would say is that obviously it has been discussed at some length in this place. I responded, I think, to an urgent question within days, and many of you made your points very forcibly about it then. There have been numerous debates in Westminster Hall, and I and one of the Treasury Ministers met ALED and other representatives from the devolved nations as well as the NFU to discuss this in great detail a month or two after the announcement. I wouldn't say that there's not been discussion. What I would acknowledge, though, is that although there's been much discussion, the Treasury's position has stayed consistent.
Right, that's the farming minister sort of prevaricating around. At least the most interesting thing there is that this is just, they just did this. They didn't even ask to see what's going to be the effect for the Treasury, because the fact of the matter is that the money that they're making from inheritance tax is negligible. But the effect on farmers is massive.
Well, I mean, obviously this has been a controversial issue ever since it was brought in, and various people have made various points about it. The one that seems to strike home for me is that many farmers are saying that in theory they're not against this, but it's just too low, the threshold at which you have to pay the tax. So in other words, smaller farmers are being affected rather than, you know, basically the larger ones.
Well, was directed at. Why couldn't this tax fall on to corporate owners, companies, trusts, etc.
Because trusts do not bequeath things, do they? They just carry on.
Well, you can have
an
annual tax, can't you?
Well, you could.
Why not? Rather than only when you die. Well, you could. This tax doesn't affect things that don't die, like trusts or companies, but it does affect things that, it's just basically a tax on living things rather than constructs like companies and trusts.
Well, that's why wealthy people put all their money into trusts, so that for their children, people like Elon Musk and so on, create loads of trusts so that they don't have to pay any tax on it. Poor people can't afford to do that, can they?
Horrible. But anyway, so that's one thing that the Labour Party lied about when they were trying to get in people's votes, and we're going to be hearing quite a lot about that tonight. The other thing, of course, is ID cards. That wasn't anywhere near in their manifesto. But now, today, everyone's got to have an ID card if they want to work.
Our immigration system does need to be fair if we want to maintain that binding contract that our politics is built on. Otherwise, it undermines trust, undermines people's faith that we're on their side, and their belief that the state can and will work for them. And that is why today I am announcing this government will make a new free-of-charge digital ID mandatory for the right to work by the end of this Parliament. Let me spell that out. You will not be able to work in the United Kingdom if you do not have digital ID. It's as simple as that. Because decent, pragmatic, fair-minded people, they want us to tackle the issues that they see around them. And of course, the truth is, we won't solve our problems if we don't also take on the root causes, looking upstream to tackle poverty, conflict, climate change, issues that aren't just intolerable for those of us who care about inequality and injustice wherever it's found in the world, but which have clear consequences for our own citizens. Take Russia's aggression in Ukraine. We all have a responsibility for the future of our continent, to stand tall where oppression and violence rears its head. But it is also about energy security, because Putin and other tyrants have used their control over energy supplies as a threat. They've pushed up energy bills, threatened to keep doing so unless they get their way. And that's why we're investing in our own energy, sovereign control over our own future, whether that's nuclear, wind, solar power. Now, this will create good jobs, but it will also take the boot of tyrants like Putin off our throat. So our mission to become a clean energy superpower is about future-proofing energy supply, bringing energy bills down, and protecting the planet that we all live on, doing right by our values and by our countries and our citizens. Because in this era, we must be the nation builders. We must be the patriots in our countries. We must show working people that we, and only we, can deliver the pride and belonging they seek. Their communities strong, cohesive, changed for the better, taking control of our future, tackling the big challenges, whether that's climate change or illegal migration, not shying away from them. That is how we win. That is how we rebuild. That's how renewal defeats grievance. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
So that's the end of Starmer's speech, where he's announcing ID cards. He's saying it's all about migrants, Martin, but it's not really, is it? We were just having a discussion there amongst us here in the studio. You've got an ID card. It's called a national insurance card and a national insurance number, haven't you? It's digital. It's got a magnetic strip on. It's on a database. So what do we need this for? Is it just some sort of thing where you can say, well, I want to see your ID? And it's a way of maybe stopping people working, or they don't want to work?
Well, what struck me about that is how it wasn't really about ID cards at all. He launched into all this stuff about Putin and the climate and all the rest of it. How are ID cards going to stop Putin? I mean, what's that got to do with anything? What he's doing there is he's trying to pitch a political pitch. Because ID cards, he's trying to get it through on the basis that if you want to stop illegal immigration, we need ID cards. Because you remember, Tony Blair tried to do this years ago, and the opposition just, opposition from various quarters, it didn't happen. I think it's going to be interesting to see if he manages to get this through, because it doesn't look as if any of the opposition parties are going to support this.
No.
So he'll have to whip the Labour Party to support it, and many of them possibly won't. So in other words, it may turn out that this is, he's trying to get something through that he's not going to be able to get through.
Another thing I've noticed, a lot of the press are dead against it as well. So this is something which raised its ugly head back in it was the 2007-8-9, wasn't it? Just before the end of the Gordon Brown government, they were kept talking about this. But there was a massive campaign against it back in those days. What do you think about the principles, anyway, about why should or shouldn't people have? I mean, we've already got a passport, a national insurance number, haven't we? What's the problem with having an ID card too?
Well, in a sense, we're already, under observation, because, if you interact with the government at all, you've got to have some kind of ID that they can recognise you by. I suspect that this has got a lot to do with Trump's visit the other week, because he represents the tech billionaires in the US, and that's what they want.
This is Palantir, isn't it?
This is what they want, and that's why we're Starmer is doing is he's bringing in the stuff that they want, because they're the ones, he's trying to butter those people up.
How's he getting on?
Well, I mean, what happens with those people? They say, thank you very much, Sakir, now we want something else. So in actual fact, it's a one-way street, isn't it?
It seems to me the whole sort of principle of you must have an ID card is, or to work, etc., is it's like a guilty until proven innocent. Is this whole thing of, well, if you, we don't trust anybody, the government doesn't trust anybody, and so if there's going to be an interaction between two people on whatever level it is, particularly if it's to do with a workplace or a job, we want to know what's going on, we want to observe it, we want to watch it. But the main thing is, you've got this whole, well, they talked about it as the Gestapo years, didn't they, in occupied Europe, Nazi-occupied Europe in the early 1940s, late 1930s, is that they would come up to you and say, I want your card, let me see your card, deine Kartbitte.
Yes, and of course, in actual fact, in other European countries, they've always had... you know, not digital, but you've got to carry an identity document with a photograph in it. That's just normal in France and other places. We've never had that here for historical reasons, but it's not, it's fairly normal elsewhere. I mean, you've got to carry it with you. For example, in France, you've got to carry your driving license with you at all times.
Why should some sort of official be able to come up to you and just demand that you prove who you are? Why should they?
See, what he's saying there is, if you want to stop people working illegally, then that's one of the things you might do. You know, some of the loyalists in Northern Ireland in County Antrim, they're going around asking anybody with a black face, have you got a piece of paper that says you're allowed to be here? And that's just local people trying to get rid of them. And of course, that, you know, all of us exist within the purview of the state.
Your papers.
Yes.
Give us your papers.
Yes. Yeah, these aren't even police officers. These are just random vigilantes.
Yeah, but this is incorporating that mentality into the national law.
It is, but it's, the authoritarian tendencies of New Labour have been there all along, haven't they? They are in the pocket of the billionaire class. The billionaire class do want digital ID. Ask Bill Gates. That's what he wants. He wants it for everybody in the world. And of course, you know, obliging as he is, Sir Keir is going to give it to him. Although, as you say, it's nothing about it in the Labour manifesto, or about increasing nuclear weapons, or about spending money on loads of new weaponry, or about anything. But of course, but what's definitely not in the last Labour manifesto was any taxes on wealth. And that we're going to stick to. Even if it means that we've got to, keep the two-child benefit cap, and we've got to make pensioners pay for their energy. At least we're going to keep one of our promises, which is no taxes on wealth. Although you can see people like Andy Burnham are suggesting from Manchester that maybe we do need some taxes on wealth.
Oh, so I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? Could it be that this going for the ID cards, which are so massively unpopular in politics and the press and amongst the population, even not that that normally makes much of a difference, but this could be Starmer's poll tax moment.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think he's going to find he's got a majority of 200 and something. So if he whips the Labour Party to support it, he ought to be able to get it through. But I think he's going to find there's an awful lot of opposition, as Tony Blair did. Now, ultimately, though, of course, as we said at the beginning of the conversation, whether you've got ID cards, digital ID cards or not, you don't get away from being surveyed by the state.
Well, no, but you're also going to see, surely, a more of a move to paying people in cash, people that don't want these cards and that are going to have them.
Well, that's right. So if you get rid of cash, then people can't be paid cash in hand, can they?
Oh, right. So this is about getting rid of cash too, you think?
Well, I think the whole push to digitalise everything is very definitely where the tech...
You can't do anything unless it's going bip, bip, bip on somebody's database.
That's right, yeah. That's what they want. Yeah. And, of course, that's the future, Tony.
That's digital slavery, Martin.
Yes, it is. And don't forget this great big deal that he announced with Trump. What that effectively is, and Chakrabarti writing in The Guardian has pointed out, what this means is building loads of data centres in Britain, which will use up massive amounts of energy.
No, they won't. No, they will be building their own little mini nuclear power stations.
All right,
in fact, they will be buying up some old nuclear power stations, refurbishing them to drive their data centres.
Yes, I know, but the point is that, as Chakrabarti points out in the book, once they're built, they're not going to employ anybody. You know, data centres don't employ people. You need security guards and people to sweep up, but you don't need loads of people to work them.
They gobble up energy, and they were. Nigel Farage is on course to be Prime Minister, according to a seat-by-seat YouGov poll today, which reveals the state of the Conservative implosion. So I imagine you're rubbing your hands about that. But the YouGov MRP polling projection, based on 13,000 sample taken over the last 3 weeks, suggests the election held tomorrow would see Reform UK win winning 311 of the 650 seats, 15 seats short of a formal winning line of 326. In practice, once the Speaker and absent Sinn Féin MPs are accounted for, it would be impossible for anyone but Mr Farage to be the next Prime Minister.
On what percentage of the vote?
I'll put the graph up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The biggest collapse really seems to have been Labour and
Conservative. Yes, but what percentage of Reform got?
This is about how many seats they get.
I want to know how many, what percentage of the votes they've got, because it's only in this country that you can win on that basis. You can't win in France, Italy, Spain, Ireland, Denmark, or Norway.
We're talking about this country. We're not talking about those countries.
No, Ireland's a different country, Tony. Yeah. And they have different elections
so
in Northern Ireland.
Farage is not standing in Ireland, is
he? No, he's not. But in actual fact, as I've said before, if they win a majority with less than 50% of the vote, as we go into the biggest crisis in capitalist history,
that's what's happened with Labour and Starmer.
Yeah, yes.
This happens all the time in Britain.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
It has happened, but it shouldn't happen, Tony.
It shouldn't happen, Tony. Well, you're going to have to carry on with your campaign with Nick Clegg or whoever it is to change the electoral system then, aren't you? Yeah. You have to work with the system you've got, I'm afraid.
No, you don't. Sometimes there's a civil war, Tony, like there was in Northern Ireland.
So,
which two Tory prime ministers were nearly killed.
That's your answer to Farage, is it?
Elon Musk told the Tony Robinson people...
How about if Labour pulled their socks up and started campaigning for things that people wanted?
Yes, okay.
Isn't that a bit better than civil war?
No.
I'm saying
I want Labour...
You're a Labour Party member.
I'm a Labour Party member and I might vote for Burnham to get out Starmer, okay? Burnham's in favour of PR. And, of course, he was elected on PR in Manchester because the mayors used to be elected with a transferable vote, although Priti Patel got rid of that. Now, in actual fact, whether the vote is fair is a very serious question. In lots of countries in Europe, we've seen colour revolutions where people just refuse to accept the vote.
The collapse, it's quite clear, has been in the Labour vote.
Yes.
267 less seats would likely to be won, according to this YouGov poll. And the Reform Party are up 306. I mean, this is just a political reality. Unless you have yourself a civil war between now and the next general election, this is what's happening, Martin.
Yes, but maybe Scotland and Wales will have independence. Because their majority in those countries will be voting for the SNP.
Well, the SNP are up 30. That's true. The Conservatives are only down, if you can say only down 76 seats. But the Labour are down 267 seats. I'll put these graphs up on our show page at this
week. What has happened to the Labour left-wing vote, which is what most of the Labour voters they've lost, is the people who voted for them because they wanted socialist policies and they can't get them.
Anyway, let's have a listen to our apparently next Prime Minister.
What is coming down the track will best part bankrupt us, although some might say we're almost there, looking at the 30-year gilt yields this morning. Under a Reform government, welfare will be for UK citizens only. It will not be for foreign-born nationals. Indeed, we'll become like most normal countries in the world. And in particular, what we're focusing on this morning is the Boris wave. The Boris wave after his huge victory in 2019, and I think the millions that came in the years of his premiership, represents the greatest betrayal of democratic wishes, certainly in anyone's living memory. This is not what Brexit voters wanted, and it's certainly not what any Conservative voter wanted from 2010 onwards, where at election after election after election they were promised that net migration would come down to tens of thousands a year, and we learn it was up to, in the worst year, a million, although we haven't yet got the revisions. By the time they come in, it almost certainly will be over 1 million. The anticipated cost of the 800,000 plus who will qualify for indefinite leave to remain over the course of the next 3 to 4 years, the anticipated cost of this group of people is a staggering £230 billion. It is absolutely an eye-watering sum of money. We will not only say that these people do not qualify for indefinite leave to remain, we will abolish indefinite leave to remain as a category in this country. Zia will lay out in a minute the... Oh, dear. That's not very good, is it? Well, things go wrong, hey. We'll laugh and carry on. Zia will outline the visa scheme in just a moment. But, you know, you come on a work visa. You can't bring a dependent with you. You can't claim benefits. And, of course, there'll be a route to citizenship, but a much tougher route to citizenship than we currently have. As I say, we will become like normal countries all over the world. And it's vital that we do this and vital that we get it right. This is grossly unfair on taxpayers. They are being absolutely hammered to pay for people who are not British citizens. And in terms of the national debt, which I touched on earlier, well, we've got major, major problems looming there already. We are not the world's food bank. It is not for us to provide welfare for people coming in from all over the world. The 800,000 people that will get indefinite leave to remain unless this policy is revoked tend to be young, tend to be low-skilled. They are going to be a huge burden on the state. And yes, of course, there's been debate in the newspapers this morning about those already here with indefinite leave to remain. And we just don't know. We don't know, because the figures aren't available, just how many of those are currently claiming benefits. What we do know is that 1 in 6 claimants of universal credit alone today, 1 in 6 is a foreign-born national. And we don't have the relevant figures for PIP and many of the other benefits that are available. Getting numbers out of this and the last government has proved a very difficult thing to do. So, yes, we'll have work visas. And I've made it very, very clear. You come here to work and you're working. And what we're announcing today is, without doubt, a very bold set of proposals. It takes us away from where the debate in British politics has been for the last 25 years. But it does actually put the British people first. And that's why the document is entitled Prioritising UK Citizens. And that is the right, proper, decent and fair thing to do. I will hand over now to Zia Yusuf.
So that's Nigel Farage, Reform UK leader, next Prime Minister, most likely, according to polls that we've been running here for the last 6 or 8 months and today on YouGov. Whether you like it or not, Martin, the thing is there is a growing number of people who this is appealing to. He's talking about deporting people who are illegal rather than putting them through the asylum system. Now, that might work through the courts and it might not. We've had these sorts of promises before. But this is, I think, you know, it's quite clear this is what people are going to vote for.
Well, you're mixing two things up. He's talking about people who are here on work visas.
Yeah, well, not illegal what migration. What you got there was just a part of the speech, right? He's okay, also talking about deportations.
Yes, yes. Okay, so let's just separate the two things out. Of course, he's jumped onto the bandwagon. We've got to get rid of all these people who come in on work visas. That is by far the most people.
No, he's saying we're going to keep them. But he's saying all the other people that come with people who are on work visas, no, they're not coming.
So you can't bring your dependents. So in other words,
what he's saying.
Okay, well, what will happen? The reason why we've had loads of people coming here to work in the last few decade or so is because the social care system and the universities are the main culprits, and the NHS. So, in actual fact, because we haven't raised taxes on the wealthy, taxes on wealthy people in the 1950s in this country were 95%, okay? And we could afford lots of different things that we can't afford
now.
Well,
it's partly because of that. It's partly also because of the massive cost of living and the fact that that it's very difficult for businesses to afford to pay local people. It's much cheaper and it's more affordable to import people.
That's right, and because in the social care system, right, the amount of money that's paid per hour for care isn't decided by the free market, Tony. It's decided by how much the government is prepared to pay for it. Now, at that level, you can't just... And, of course, we've privatised the care system. We used to have council-owned care homes in Bristol, run by the council, with trade union people working in trade unions on much better wages than they get now.
Yes, and I think it was around
about... privatised it all.
On this show.
That's right.
In around about 2011, 2012. 2012, it was the local Lib Dems who shut them all down. I mean, that's, I think, right. We had something like 15 elderly care homes.
So, moving on from that, the point is, Tony, that once you've privatised the sector...
Can we just say that was a result of 2008, wasn't it?
The bailouts. That's right. And so the money that we should have spent on social care got used to bail out the banks. That's where the money went, and that's why they've got no money. Now, the reason why they're bringing people in is because if you're a private care home manager and you are trying to make a profit on what you're doing with the money that you can get from the government, then the only way to make that work is to bring people in from outside, which is what they've done. Now, for example, in Leinster, where my family live, my sister was chatting to a guy in the park, and he was, she's got to know him, he's an elderly chap, and she said to him, "Well, what have you been doing this morning?" "I've been to see the doctor." He said, "Oh, how was that then?" "Well, he was a black doctor from Nigeria, so I told him to get back to the jungle." Now, the problem is the NHS is staffed by loads and loads of people from outside Britain. Mm. And if they weren't here, there'd be nobody else to do those jobs.
Right. And actually, the NHS is massively understaffed with doctors. You've got plenty of the low-paid staff, but this is one of the reasons, of course, the doctors have been on strike.
Indeed. The only way we can raise wages, Tony, is by raising taxes on wealthy people like Farage.
No, it isn't. No, rubbish. All you do is you reduce... things like rent, you reduce people's overheads, you reduce transport costs.
How do you do that, Tony, in a privatised economy? All right, so we've got to nationalise everything, increase taxes on wealthy people, and then we can solve all these problems.
I think we can, yeah.
Yeah, somebody should tell Nigel Farage.
Yeah, well, I don't think
he's one of the wealthy people that needs more taxes to pay, doesn't he?
He wants to...
Well, how much is he worth? In Norway, we'd know how much he was worth.
I know you hate Farage, but he's going to beat you, because he is going to get more votes than your silly Labour Party, which is collapsing.
I'm an Irish Republican, Tony.
Okay. Fair enough.
You said Labour Party, your choice.
Labour Party member, aren't you?
That's right.
Anyway, there is a terrible crisis with the overheads that people have got to pay and the cost of living. News item this week, it revealed that the average family has got a energy bill debt of £1,700 right now. So that's what privatisation of gas and electricity has
done. No, it's what Americans blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline does. We've got an enemy, and it isn't Putin. No, it's the United States of America who blew up the pipeline.
The enemy is whoever owns these privatised utilities.
No, the privatised utilities are profiteering on the back of the shortage created by an act of war by the United States against the European Union.
That's part of it, but they're actually price-fixing, too.
Martin,
stop shouting, please. What they're actually doing is they're price-fixing. Anyway, let's have a listen to this report this week about the cost of living crisis and how much debt people have got on their energy bills. Thank you very much for privatising it all, Mrs Thatcher.
The total amount of energy debt and arrears in Britain now stands at more than £4.4 billion. It's the highest level since records began and up more than £750 million compared to the same point last year. Our cost of living correspondent Coletta Smith has the details.
April, May and June aren't the months we spend the most on energy. So it's even more concerning that it was during this period that the total amount of energy debt and the number of households struggling to pay reached new highs. The figures published by the energy regulator Ofgem also show that across England, Scotland and Wales, there are more than 1 million households who've no agreement with their provider to repay that debt. That was the position Jed Higgins from Hyde in Greater Manchester found himself in earlier this year.
When you're in debt and you can't pay it and you're worried about bailiffs knocking on your door, it does your head in and it scares you. And each day, each week that passes, it's building up. It's not like as if I just pull the money out of my pocket and go, it's not a problem and all that. It's not. It's an horrible feeling.
Jed has now got on top of his energy bills, but these figures show that the average amount owed for energy now stands at £1,716 per household. Energy prices for standard tariffs are increasing next week, which will add more pressure on customers. The regulator Ofgem is due to announce a plan this autumn to deal with the growing mountain of energy debt. And the crucial part of that will be deciding who should eventually cover the cost of arrears that can't be repaid.
So actually, it's not the average that people average people owe £1,700. Is it if you are in energy debt? That is the average £1,700 people are owing, Martin. And of course, he's right. It's very debilitating. Of course, it means that for some people, even just paying the standing charge, they can't afford to because they don't have the income. That's the problem. This is the problem at the heart of everything we've been talking about.
the whole of Western and Eastern Europe is going to have a depression, not a recession, a depression. Because by
3 years ago exactly, wasn't it, Nord Stream?
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, what it's done, the US basically has decided to crash the European economy so that they can cannibalise it. So they're forcing what it's not really happening. German industrialists are being forced to relocate either to China or to the United States or just go out of business altogether. What is going to happen is that the rest of the world is going to actually forge ahead. Britain and Europe, we are going to have a depression, which will involve loads of people losing their houses, their jobs and all sorts. And it may well be, ultimately, a civil war situation, certainly in some parts of Europe. It was in Yugoslavia.
Right, so I think it's a good time to get the poem, this week's poem from Patrizia. It's really looking at the whole ID cards business, so... it's called Destiny DNA. A group of ghouls, all power mad, where wealth and power all turned to bad, will meet and greet behind closed doors. Deciders sit on coming wars. Fresh faces groom from early age in politics, so games are staged. Compromat and cunning plans use, abuse each woman, man, stooges all in well-cut clothes, primed to pose on stage, verbose. It's like that speech by Starmer is so like it's just been written by AI. I'd love to know if it really was or not. In fact, you don't need to know, it kind of was, wasn't it? Democracy, a word they poke. Front and centre, what a joke. Man on the street, short Wes he came. Backstory ripened for their game. On politics, amuse, some say, for Hewitt's plan to do away with NHS. Sore point that sticks when mixed with dirty, rotten tricks. TB still lurks, mixed up in hell. On street, perhaps, he casts a spell. LFOI, tattoo a mark, so bidding's done in darkest dark. AI rogues, like Pfizer man, who made a killing with dirty plan, mining data, DNA, predicting health, our lives to sway. DID, a card must hold our private lives, writ all in code. Subscribe, pay up, a money shaker, or Palantir, a jailer maker. Trojan horse, a trap laid wait. Refuse to pay, your life will bait. An underclass, persona non grata, as Bilderbergs, our lives see barter. Thank you, Patrizia. And so the ID card, yes, quite clearly, very, very dangerous, nasty little thing, completely unnecessary. We're looking at this sort of cost, these massive energy costs. One of the things they has happened over the last few decades, certainly since I've been involved in environmental movements since the early 1990s, is the demise of Friends of the Earth. Where are they? Campaigning on nuclear issues. The group Radiation Free Lakeland, for many years, the people who now form that group, they were working as part of Friends of the Earth up in Cumbria. Do you want to just say something, Martin, about the importance of Sellafield up there? It used to be called Windscale, didn't it? But it's become, for some reason, Cumbria, one of the beautiful, most beautiful parts of the Lake District of England, has somehow also become a real bugbear, because this is where nuclear waste is sent from all over the world.
Well, I think they chose the Lake District because it was relatively unpopulated. So if anything happened, there'd be less people hurt. But of course, that's right. It's become a nuclear dustbin.
So a few years ago, when Friends of the Earth started taking more of an interest in saying that nuclear power was a good thing, so that's when Radiation-Free Lakeland started to set up. So let's have a listen now to the current chair of Radiation-Free Lakeland, Marianne Birkby, who talks about their disagreements with people from Friends of the Earth from London, the actual local people who live in the Lake District, because what been happening for years is they've been planning to bury some low-level waste there, build a great big hole in the ground and bury it, and now this week Ed Miliband, the Energy and Climate Change Secretary, has said, oh, we're going to do it. And by the way, it's not going to be, we're not going to ask the local people, number one. Number two, it's not going to be low-level waste. It's going to be high-level waste. We're just going to stick it in the ground and forget about it.
That was the whole reason why Radiation Free Lakeland set up. I mean, I'm not actually a sort of person that likes to take a lead on anything. But we sort of felt that we had to. I mean, I was a very keen member of Friends of the Earth and did lots of campaigns with them on GM crops and nuclear, you know, lots and lots of things. But it was kind of like really sort of from too late 1990s, really, that they sort of started winding, backing away, really, or backpedalling from nuclear. And I remember so many motions to conference. You know, I went to conferences and we voted again year on year to say, yes, we want to campaign on nuclear. It's really important. And all the hands went up, but the motions were never, you know, they were never passed. It was like, oh, well, we can't do that because we're focusing on climate, which was really frustrating, to say the least, and also, as you say, extremely worrying. And it felt like you were banging your head against a brick wall. It just was incredibly sort of visceral for me, you know, as a, I was quite a loyal Friends of the Earth kind of person, and it just felt like a complete betrayal of everything. You know, if you're not opposing nuclear, which really has the potential of all industries to end all life on planet Earth, then really, what is the point of being a friend of the Earth? You know, it's kind of, it's a very sort of visceral thing.
Could you just clarify? So was it that motions were being voted down by the Friends of the Earth membership, or was it just that they weren't being implemented by the leadership of Friends of the Earth?
They weren't being implemented. No, the motions were all, everybody's hand almost went up, but they, you know, the motions are then looked at, and the board and the, you know, directors or whatever of Friends of the Earth then decide to what to do, you know, what to take on.
Well, it's what do you think was going on there? Because you do have to question if the Friends of the Earth are saying, well, the shutdown of, say, gas-fired power stations is more important than the shutdown of nuclear power stations. Now, clearly, the nuclear power stations are far, far more polluting, and they're far more connected to the weapons industry than gas. So what did you get any sense at all of what was going on in their heads?
No sense at all. Not any. But I kind of felt like there'd been some sort of deal done, you know, because it was around a, you know, the Department of the Energy and Climate Change was formed, and it felt like a sort of deal was done, not just Friends of the Earth, but Greenpeace too. You know, they backpedalled on active. I mean, they were quite happy to be asked, you know, when something happens, you know, like when this, you know, anything happens regarding nuclear, Friends of the Earth are always the go-to people that the media like to go to. But as for actually doing any active campaigning on nuclear, you know, unless I've missed it, it's kind of been non-existent. And my feeling is that there was some deal done between big NGOs and government when the Department of Energy and Climate Change came in. It was kind of like, oh, well, you know, we're giving climate change a whole department, and in a sort of quid pro quo, you know, you will agree not to overtly campaign on nuclear.
So that's Marianne Birkby speaking from the Lake District. Friends of the Earth, rather unpopular amongst the members of Radiation Free Lakeland. In fact, they had to split away from Friends of the Earth and do their own thing because Friends of the Earth seem to be supporting. Why is this, Martin? What is going on? She's got her own theories there about why Friends of the Earth have relinquished their interest in nuclear, although they say they haven't. She's saying, well, what they're doing is they're spending their money on doing things like stopping coal fire power stations rather than stopping nuclear power stations now.
Well, obviously, you know, you'll have to talk to the people concerned. I mean, I can speculate about what the motivations are. clearly there's been a shift against, you know, some people, George Monbiot, obvious example, who see nuclear power as a solution to so-called climate emergency. So that's the split there. I mean, the Greens in Germany started off as a determinedly anti-nuclear party, and they closed down virtually all their nuclear power stations. But of course, they've got a huge problem because of the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They haven't really got any energy solutions. And of course, you know, energy is just going to be very, very expensive for the reasons we discussed in the earlier bit. And that will mean that businesses are unviable. People won't be able to make a living. And we're going to have a very, very hard time. That's what's going to happen in Europe. That's what we're staring at.
Well, staying with politics and the Labour Party, the ruling Labour Party, we'll be talking, by the way, a little bit more. I'm going to hear a bit from Dr. Chris Busby, what he makes of this underground nuclear storage after the break. But what about the Labour Party? Martin, there's been a lot of things happening whilst I've been away, and one of them is this massive march in London on the Saturday before last by the Tommy Robinson Brigade, the absolutely amazing, which I reported on last week, and I did a piece about it on the New Zealand, what's it called? TPTV, I think it's what it's called. Turning on. Anyway, I'm not quite sure what they're called, but they Maoris for genocide. So we had the Maoris dancing at the Tommy Robinson organised rally with about between 110 and 150,000 people there in central London. What did you make of all that? Because people like Andrew Bridgen turned up, they were asked to turn up. People had come from Australia and Canada, been asked to come over to speak, but they were not allowed to. They didn't have time for them. But they did have time for a church from Auckland, a Christian Zionist church, which is half Maoris and half white people, dressed as Maoris, doing a haka for Israel and against Palestine, and then tearing up the Palestine flag. So what did you make of this big march? It's supposed to be one of the biggest right-wing marches ever to take place, or far-right marches ever to take place in the UK.
Well, the obvious thing to point out, first of all, is that 2 weeks before that, there was a pro-Palestine march. We've had 300,000 people on it, but nobody reported on it. Everybody's reporting on this one, but nobody... That was the weekend where the people were arrested for Palestine actions, yeah? So the media focused on that. But at the same time, there was a march which was three times the size of this march. But that's not reported in the media.
Maybe twice. Maybe two or three
bigger.
Times. Yeah,
that's all I'll say.
And, also, I would observe this sort of thing from a media point, from a journalistic point of view, is on the Sunday morning after the march, I was listening to UK radio, and on the bulletins they had little excerpts from Tommy Robinson's speech at the march. Now, you never have Palestine rally, whoever it is happens to be speaking, you know, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn or whoever, you never ever have those on the bulletins. But at the far right march, Tommy Robinson's voice is being reported on the news bulletins around the country.
Well, that's right. So we both picked up on the way these things are reported. If they were objectively reported, you would see that there are two big teams here. Yeah. Their team and our team. But we've got a bigger team. Now, the other thing I'd point out about thing that made me really angry about this, Elon Musk, on video, spoke to the assembled masses there with their British flags, Israeli flags and all the rest of it. And he said, you may not want violence, but violence is coming to you. It's time to fight or die. Now, you were having a go at me earlier for calling this a civil war. This is a white South African billionaire, not in fact the richest man in the world now, because the guy who owns Oracle has just pipped him to that. But he is telling people in Britain that they've got to go to war.
Well, not only
it's
that.
It's not me telling them, it's Elon Musk telling them.
We also had this so-called Rebel News, the Tommy Robinson channel, interviewing an ex-convict of some sort who the police say they're trying to track down, who was calling for the assassination of Keir Starmer. Now, to me, that is not something you transmit as a responsible journalist. If someone calls for someone to be assassinated, you don't transmit that. You hand it over to the police, because this is a criminal offence to call for someone's murder.
Well, you've got to understand how upset people are, Tony, about the immigrants. They've been taking their places in hospitals
Normalising. They're trying to normalise this idea that, oh, it's okay to go and murder someone and actually to call for their death and call for assassinations. That seems to be what's going on. Being normalised.
I would suggest to you that they're being treated with kid gloves in the way that Palestine Action is not. Reverend Sue Parfitt has never called for anybody to be murdered, but she's potentially a terrorist facing 14 years in prison. What about Elon Musk? He was calling for a civil war in our country. What should happen to him? Should he be arrested, do you think?
No, what's the Labour Party doing? The Labour Party has obviously split with Jeremy Corbyn and various other individuals starting this new thing called Your Party. I see that everything seems to be falling apart, as predicted by David Miller. And he did a podcast this week all about this. And it's also interesting to see that he's won a court victory today, where he, although the campaign against anti-Semitism were trying to be part of this court case because they're rather well heeled, funded by the Israelis. And the court has ruled that they can't be part of it. Because it's nothing to do with the actual case against him, which I think is probably still to do with this Bristol University business. But anyway, let's have a listen now to David Miller talking about the fall of this Jeremy Corbyn Your Party.
It's been an intense period of the last 2 months, and it's you can tell the story in relation to the dispute between what you can characterise as the Corbyn faction and the Sultana faction in Your Party. But that narrative, which I feel I'd kind of got on top of a couple of weeks ago, has now been completely queered by the emergence of something called Our Party, which has put the cat amongst the pigeons and is itself a very complex set of relations. So I probably need to talk about that a little bit. But let's go back to explaining the Corbyn faction and the Sultana faction. So essentially, thinking back to when Corbyn was leader of the party, we'll remember that there was the anti-Semitism scam where thousands of party members were accused of being anti-Semitic for criticizing Israel. And crucial to remember is the fact that the scam, or at least the witch hunt against those members, only really took off once Jeremy Corbyn's people had a grip on the bureaucracy of the Labour Party. That is, once Jenny Formby was appointed as General Secretary, and once Corbyn was able to appoint people to all the relevant committees. In the period before Jenny Formby became General Secretary, one person was expelled in the previous year, and in the period afterwards it was 45, and the year afterwards it was 45, and then after that, many more. And of course, all of the most famous cases were cases of people who were expelled on Corbyn's watch when Jenny Formby was in charge. Of course, we're thinking of Chris Williamson, Jackie Walker, and the many other cases of people who are not as famous. I should mention Mark Wadsworth as well, someone who did literally the least of anybody and was expelled on Corbyn's watch. And these people, let's remember, have to this day not been rung up by Jeremy or had any announcement in the press that Jeremy was sorry or that he felt he shouldn't have done it or that this won't happen again. None of that has happened. And that's why there is a question mark, or at least where there was a question mark some weeks ago. I mean, we've moved way beyond question mark now, about his whether he'd learned any lessons. So we said all these things at the time. We said, look, the people who were in charge of the anti-Semitism committee inside the Labour Party when he was in charge, appointed by Jenny Formby and by Corbyn, these were people who were witch hunters, and these were people who were informed by Zionist ideas and engaged in the witch hunt. And these three people were Harry Habel, who'd been in Momentum and been actually reporting people for anti-Semitism before he became part of the anti-Semitism hit squad, a guy called Patrick Smith, who had been in the well-known Zionist Trotskyist faction, the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, and of course Laura Murray, famously the daughter of Andrew Murray. And they worked closely also with a press person in the Labour Party called Georgie Robertson, who of course is the daughter of the famous lawyer Geoffrey Robertson. Now, the four of them were core to expelling large numbers of people from the party for no reason at all. For criticizing Israel. And there's never been an accounting for that process. There's never been Jeremy Corbyn or anyone close to Corbyn saying, we got that wrong last time. We shouldn't have expelled so many people. We actually undermined ourselves. We shot ourselves in the foot. We apologized too much for things which we hadn't done wrong, which weren't wrong. And of course, that apology, apologize and move on strategy was overseen and pushed by one of Corbyn's other advisors, his strategic communication advisor, James Schneider. So it's those people who are responsible. Now, some people have said, you know, oh, well, Jeremy just went along with it. He didn't know. He didn't understand. Schneider wrote his stuff. He didn't necessarily approve of it. And that argument has been one which I think some of us were more sympathetic to perhaps 2 or 3 years ago. But now that doesn't really appear to stand up. And we've seen what's happened in relation to Corbyn's ability to deal with the question of anti-Zionism. And he very, you know, publicly, made his response after it was the case that Zara Sultana said at Beautiful Days, the festival in Devon, an event where she did a talk, and I was present at it, where she said for the first time, "I'm a proud anti-Zionist." And of course, people liked that because it was the first time someone had been so openly anti-Zionist. And then this activist in London saw Jeremy at a meeting. Are you an anti-Zionist? And he froze and he didn't know what to say and he wouldn't answer. And his press advisor, Ollie DeRose, sort of pushed her away and asked her to stop recording and all of that. And so that made it pretty clear that he was not willing to say that he was an anti-Zionist. Now,
so there's David Miller there talking about this this bizarre situation where Corbyn cannot say he's anti-Zionist. I mean, is that important, do you think, for Corbyn's, your party, to adopt an anti-Zionist position? He seems to me to be pro-Palestinian, but also pro-Israeli.
Well, that's a split between him and Zara Sultana, of course, because Zara Sultana is an anti-Zionist.
Does it matter?
Well, obviously it does matter. And, you know,
it seemed to me, you know, you can actually be anti-Israel, but still a Zionist, can't you?
It's logically possible, and some people claim that they are. But obviously, these tensions are, you know, do cause difficulties.
What about Jews that are over in protesting against Netanyahu now? They may be, you know, pro the state of Israel as an idea, but totally against this present government.
Well, they would be a classic example of people who are, you know, they're not anti-Zionist, but they're anti-Israeli government policy.
That's Corbyn's position, maybe. And would you think David Miller's maybe labouring this, that it's okay to be pro-Zionist, just so long as you're against the genocide and against the present Israeli government? Because Israel's not always been this bad.
Well, I mean, there's going to be a spectrum of views on that, isn't there? My own views is I'm a firm anti-Zionist. You know, I've given up on trying to... I'm not really that interested in who runs the state of Israel because the state of Israel is illegitimate. And that goes for the state of the United States as well. It's not a democracy. I don't see why we have to recognise...
What about Britain?
We were talking about this earlier. If people can get to power and have a 130-seat majority with 30% of the vote, that isn't a democracy, Tony. It just isn't. And that's where civil wars happen, like in Yugoslavia and in Ireland. Anyway, moving back to the question of anti-Semitism, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has got many positive qualities as a political leader and obviously many weaknesses. And obviously it's very difficult for the left to organise itself because, of course, they're talking about having a party conference for your party or whatever it's going to... I think Zara Sultana wants to call it the Left Party. It's not quite clear what Corbyn wants to call it.
I can't understand why they have to do all this in public. Why don't they just have a proper meeting, make a few decisions on what to call themselves, what their policies are, privately?
No,
the right always seems to be able to do
this
perfectly
well. Yes,
because
the right is hierarchical.
But the left always seems to do everything in public.
Okay, well, that's the difference. You see, Reform was set up by Nigel Farage as a personal... It's actually not a political party. It's actually a company, limited company, owned
but
by Farage.
Isn't it sensible to get all your ducks in a row before you go to the public?
Well, the thing is, the left have this principle, Tony, it's very boring and annoying, of internal democracy.
Shambolic.
It's shambolic, isn't it? Democracy is quite shambolic. Unlike Reform, which is actually owned by Farage. So we can just get rid of anybody he doesn't like, just like that. Bang!
So it's okay to air your dirty linen in public. Is that what the idea of...
No, it isn't.
That's not leadership, is it?
No, but when you're not comparing like with like. the right wing can have hierarchical parties. The Tory party never used to have any internal democracy at all. Back in the day, in the 1950s, if you could be a member of the Conservative Party, we had no say in who ran it or what went on.
Zara Sultana has been saying that anybody that doesn't support trans rights is not welcome in this new party.
Well, that's another of the splits on the left which are being exploited by the deep state.
It seems to me it's nothing to do with the differences between left and right. It's just these individuals think it's their party. They all think that they're in charge somehow.
Well, the problem with any kind of group like that, which you bring together, is you're going to have different views about what to do. There's no problem in reform, because Farage just decides. Like, Richard Tice is out, he doesn't like it.
It's not just reform, it's most political parties do these sorts of discussions either at a party conference or they do them in private, with an executive
in
private.
Well, in actual fact, different political parties have got different internal structures.
Anyway, it's also, I mean, one of the things David Miller is saying, I do totally agree with him on, is that he's got... Corbyn has got some people like this James Schneider guy who are there to disrupt things. They're not actually there to help things
at all.
Okay,
let's pick up on this. What the Israeli secret services do is they infiltrate everything.
Oh.
Okay? So they'll be definitely infiltrated into this. There will be people there who are definitely going to try and, you know, we could just take a strong anti-Zionist line. That's probably what most people who want to join the party would like it to take. But if you've got people in there who won't do that, then you can start a row, and then people can fall out, and then everything. It's counterintelligence propaganda. It's what the FBI did with the Black Panthers.
So, meanwhile, whilst Jeremy Corbyn's your party, our party, my party, whatever they're calling it these days, is struggling to to get any kind of policies out, we have another party that's called the Labour Party, and it's an excellent report this week, fascinating report, in fact, about, I think it's from Double Down News, I'll find out the name of the reporter in a second, taking a very, very close look at this guy, Morgan McSweeney. He's the Keir Starmer's chief of staff, Martin. He was involved, apparently, a lot in the getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn in the first place. So he's a Starmerite. But anyway, I'll let you comment after we've heard from Double Down News. I think important, looking at the funding for Morgan McSweeney over the years. Where's it been coming from, and why has he been lying to hide it?
This is the story about a man you may never have heard of. A man by the name of Morgan McSweeney, the chief of staff to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Sir Keir Starmer. Arguably the most important and the most powerful person in British politics. In fact, without Morgan McSweeney, there simply is no Keir Starmer. And this is the story of how he got that power and how he used a secret, unlawful fund of over £700,000 to seize that power. This web of secrecy and these backroom deals should terrify anybody who cares about British democracy. About 4 years ago, in 2021, I got access to a phenomenal leak of documents out of the Labour Party. That sparked my investigation into Morgan McSweeney and the Labour Party, an incredible story of the reckless and arguably lawless project that has delivered us this particular Keir Starmer government. Between 2017 and 2020, Morgan McSweeney ran an undisclosed secret project to destroy the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. He did so with a pot of money, £730,000 he wasn't declaring as required by law to the Electoral Commission. While he was running the secret project, he wrote to the Electoral Commission and spoke to them over the phone and said, I don't want to report donations. And the Electoral Commission said, I'm sorry, you have to report donations. And in February 2020, Shibana Mumbud, who's currently the Home Secretary, said on Labour Together's behalf, yes, we are reporting donations. Labour Together was a seemingly anodyne think tank that Morgan McSweeney ran for a number of years. Labour Together really came into play after Corbyn's Labour Party exceeded all expectations in the general election of 2017. But for people like Morgan McSweeney, this wasn't something to be celebrated. This was a threat. See, Morgan McSweeney is from the right wing of the Labour Party, and Jeremy Corbyn's success was a threat to his own personal political ambitions and to his vision for the Labour Party. For a period of 3 years, Morgan McSweeney used Labour Together to undertake secret projects to destroy the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, secret projects that inflamed the anti-Semitism crisis that would undermine his reputation, but also to ensure that Keir Starmer was elected leader of the Labour Party. To do that, Morgan McSweeney needed serious money. And between 2017 and late 2020, Labour Together accepted over £800,000 in donations. Of that amount, £730,000 was not reported as required by law to the Electoral Commission. As a result, nobody had any idea that Labour Together, under Morgan McSweeney's control, was taking £730,000 from a series of multimillionaires. Two of those people who gave the money were Trevor Chin and Martin Taylor. So Trevor Chin is a wealthy UK businessman. One of his animating concerns is Israel. For the last 30 years, he's been actively involved in pro-Israel politics. He's been connected and linked to Labour Friends of Israel. In fact, early in 2025, Trevor Chin was awarded the Israeli Presidential Medal of Honour for services to the country of Israel. The other donor was a man by the name of Martin Taylor, a very secretive, wealthy hedge fund owner who has interest in private healthcare. One of the weird things about Morgan McSweeney is that he's never been interviewed properly. You'll never find a quote from him in the media. He's never been on TV to explain his beliefs or his philosophy or what he's done in the past. In all my years of researching Morgan McSweeney, I've only ever found one video of him. Here's Morgan McSweeney speaking to an assembled crowd of a Labour great and good, telling them about how Labour Together was trying to seek unity in the party.
It's a network of people from across the party, from different traditions, that look to what are long-term challenges facing the Labour Party and the country and how we overcome them.
Nothing could be further from the truth. Because at that time, Morgan McSweeney's plan to burn down the Labour Party, to undermine it from within, to capture the Labour Party from the ashes, to install their own chosen leader, and then eradicate the left wing from the Labour Party was well advanced. What we can now reveal is that Morgan McSweeney was, and is, very close to Peter Mandelson, the best pal of the notorious sex pest and paedophile, Jeffrey Epstein. In fact, one of McSweeney's first jobs at Labour was inputting data into Peter Mandelson's much-feared Excalibur computer system. Peter Mandelson has said of Morgan McSweeney, "I don't know who and how and when he was invented, but whoever it was, they will find their place in heaven." In many ways, they share the same political methodology. They're very comfortable meeting behind closed doors, making important decisions about your life, important decisions they make outside of transparency. Like, for example, forgetting to report £730,000 of donations to the Electoral Commission. So what was almost £750,000 unlawfully not declared to the Electoral Commission used for? One of the most consequent use of that money was to get Keir Starmer elected leader of the Labour Party. What we now know is that Keir Starmer had leadership ambitions from as early as 2018. He attended a series of meetings with his good friend and MP, Jenny Chaplin, hosted at Jenny Chaplin's home in Camden in London on Arlington Street. As a result, the group that met was called the Arlington Group. One of the earliest attendees of those meetings was Steve Reed MP, one of Morgan McSweeney's closest allies. In July 2019, Morgan McSweeney was invited by Steve Reed to attend one of the Arlington Group meetings. What McSweeney did was produce a detailed presentation of what the Labour Party membership wanted and who they would vote for. That information was based on hundreds of thousands of pounds of unpublished polling that Morgan McSweeney had undertaken to understand what made Labour Party members tick, what they wanted from a potential Labour Party leader. As a result, when the Labour Party suffered defeat in December 2019, Keir Starmer, Labour Together and Morgan McSweeney were immediately ready to swing into action. They were able to present a pitch of Keir Starmer as a radical eco-socialist, an inheritor of the Corbynite tradition, a man who would nationalise key industries, who would bring in a Green New Deal, that he would unite the party and end factionalism. But nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, as we now know, as soon as Keir Starmer became leader, he ditched all of his 10 pledges.
"You made 10 policy pledges for this campaign. Let's see how watertight they are. Can you guarantee that under your leadership, the 2019 Labour commitments to nationalise water, energy, rail, the Royal Mail, they'll all be in Labour's next election manifesto?"
"I've made that commitment."
"Will you nationalise the big six energy companies, yes or no?"
"No."
"No, you will not."
The fraudulent pitch that Keir Starmer offered was based entirely on Morgan McSweeney's vision of him polling the membership, understanding what needed to be said to get Labour members to vote for a leader who would then betray them. Morgan McSweeney was absolutely central to that campaign. One of the absolutely remarkable things was that through the entire period he was overseeing Keir Starmer's election campaign, he was still the company secretary of Labour Together. And in fact, during the period of Keir Starmer's leadership campaign, Labour Together was still taking in donations that Morgan McSweeney was failing to report. This is the man who's now chief of staff to the Prime Minister. This is the man, the most powerful man in the UK. How's this unelected man, a man who can't even speak to the press, who nobody has voted for, has so much power, when we now know for the entire period he was leading Keir Starmer's Labour leadership campaign, he was still the company secretary of Labour Together, and in fact failing to report donations as required by the law to the Electoral Commission?
So as I was watching this last night, I'm looking at the silly stuff on the news. Why haven't they picked up on any of this? £700,000, being donated by these two Israeli donors to the movement to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, Martin.
Well, it has been picked up on to some extent that because of the Mandelson connection, so the Tories and others have picked up on it to an extent. But of course, what they don't mention is that Jeffrey Epstein was a Mossad agent. And of course, the Israelis do run politics in this country as they do in the US, as they have done for a long time.
So the book is written by, and that there you heard was Paul Holden on Double Down News. That does look to me like an absolutely colossal political scandal. It's obviously he's done his homework and he's well referenced everything. The book is called The Fraud, Keir Starmer, Morgan McSweeney and the Crisis of British Democracy by Paul Holden. It's not even been published yet. It's out in November, apparently. This is a summary about it. It says, based on Labour Party files, including never publicly seen before, explosive investigation lays bare the intrigues, stratagems and deceits that helped deliver Sir Keir Starmer into Downing Street. Paul Holden shows how Starmer has been the front man for a ruthless right-wing political project headed by Morgan McSweeney, now Chief of Staff in Number 10, and arguably the most powerful man in Britain. And what they don't say quite there is funded by Zionist Israel backers. McSweeney's clique often employed dirty tricks to undermine the left-wing Labour leadership, fueling a moral panic over anti-Semitism and establishing front groups that hobbled prominent independent media outlets in the name of fighting misinformation. I'll put a link up to this book. I think you can pre-order it, maybe. But also interesting, the way that things are done nowadays is it's a good idea to put this stuff out. It's a lot easier to do it on YouTube than to get the book out into bookshops, etc. And I don't even know if many of the bookshop chains will want to stock something which is undermining the World Economic Forum's programme for Britain, Martin.
Well, that's right. And of course, books are increasingly endangered in any case because of, the success of of electronic media. Well, it's a very interesting book. I think what may happen is that McSweeney is going to be, if he carries on being the story, people like that can't afford to be the story. If they're going to fix things behind the scenes, they have
behind the scenes. He doesn't do interviews or anything like that. He's just hiding away.
Yes, I know, but his name's out there now. And this,
well, it's been out there. We used that report, didn't we, a few weeks ago from Ireland, which was showing that his family over in Ireland were at one time lobbying for mass migration into Ireland, but also owning many of the hostels and getting planning permission for new hostels to house them. So they were directly benefiting from the policies that they were implementing.
Well, he's from a Fine Gael family, which are they were the winners in the Irish Civil War, but they're the more right wing of the two parties, two main parties. So it's not that surprising. You know, he shouldn't really be helping the Labour Party in this country. He's an Irish right winger. Why is he in charge?
If he's hidden this £730,000 donation that he was taking during these election periods and hidden it away from the Electoral Commission, how come the police are saying, oh, well, it doesn't matter, it's just...
I don't know, Tony, but when I looked, I mean, obviously I've been picking certain things up about this, and I understand it, they've said they're not going to prosecute. But of course, if they did prosecute, he's bang to rights, isn't he?
What is his role, do you think, nowadays?
Well, you've got to compare people like him to people like Mandelson, and even more so like Alistair Campbell or Dominic Cummings, yeah? These people are becoming very important in politics, and of course their shelf life is becoming shorter as well, because people have realised that they are the movers and shakers, so they're actually interested in them. In the past, people doing these kind of roles, like people used to be around Harold Wilson, like Joe Haynes, I think his name was, he used to do similar stuff, but nobody ever heard of him. Yeah, he just got on with doing things behind the scenes and nobody ever heard of him. What's happened now is these movers and shakers
People like Bernard Ingham under Thatcher, they were quite well known.
Yes, but the really good ones, nobody knows who they are. Because that's one of the things about it.
Well, that's how he's trying. He's trying very hard to hide, isn't he? But he's not really succeeding. So anyway, it'd be interesting to see if he has his collar felt. What's your feeling for what do you think is going to happen over this?
Well, I don't think he'll have his collar felt because, as we know, the law is biased in favour of the establishment. So they get away with stuff and other people get
the book thrown out. It just seems to be more and more obvious that we've got a criminal gang running the country right now with this guy in charge there. People like Starmer are just a little actor, puppet, that reads some sort of AI-generated script for them. Anyway, we've also, talking about Ireland and McSweeney, the Police Service of Northern Ireland this week have been discovered to have been spying on journalists because the journalists were writing stories about the PSNI through their confidential sources. So the PSNI decided, right, I know, we're going to hack into their phones. We're going to try and find out how... Is this phone hacking again, isn't it? And we're going to try and find out who it is in the PSNI that's leaking this. But this is all apparently now been proven to be illegal.
An independent report has criticised the Police Service of Northern Ireland for using journalists' phone numbers to check if officers or staff may have leaked information. The review also found police unlawfully used covert powers 21 times to try to uncover reporters' confidential sources. Our correspondent Sarah Gervin reports from Belfast.
The 200-page report covers PSNI surveillance practices between 2011 and 2024. Its author, Angus McCullough, said the surveillance of journalists had not been widespread or systemic. But he did raise concerns about the practice of running journalists' phone numbers through police systems to detect contact between reporters and PSNI staff. The report says that no legal advice appears to have been sought over the legality of the practice, which was formally discontinued last year. Mr. McCullough said the scale of the operation was of significant concern. His review followed legal action by journalists Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burney, and allegations that other reporters and lawyers may have had their phones monitored. Mr. Burney described today's report as a stepping stone.
This is about the normalisation of surveillance of journalists in Northern Ireland. And you've got to ask yourself, is there not something very, very wrong at the PSNI that they felt that was lawful, when in fact it was completely unlawful?
Mr. Burney and other campaigners have called for a public inquiry. The PSNI has accepted the review's 16 recommendations and says lessons have been learned.
Yeah, well, we like to think the PSNI, Martin, are a lot better than the old RUC, don't we?
Well, to some extent they are, but at the same time, they can still get things wrong, as I've done in this case.
Get it wrong? Come on. They're just abusing. One of the most interesting things about this story is they're explaining there that the police, apparently without going to court, can just simply plug in somebody's number into some sort of mysterious system that they've got, and then go through everybody that, go through and have a look at everybody that they've been talking to. Now, that's a massive power that they've got there, and they're doing it with journalists. Now, there doesn't seem to be any proper checks and balances on it at all, and it's only because of good old Barry and Trevor, these two journos, that realised that the police had been getting numbers, I imagine, through say they're getting some information about criminality from someone that works in the police, either a police officer or a civilian worker, that civilian worker is lent on within the police. So the journalists aren't stupid, and neither are those workers. They know that somehow that the police have got hold of that information, and they've worked out that they're doing it through this unlawful means.
Well, basically, they knew what the rules were, that they're not supposed to do that, but they took no notice, and now they've been caught.
Yeah, but no prosecutions, nothing. They're saying there should be a public inquiry. There almost certainly won't be, because this is the sort of thing that the government seems to... the government is there to try and protect the police, not to protect journalists, it seems.
Well, that's right. And, of course, there's lots and lots of issues surrounding what's been going on in the six counties, as Republicans call it. If you saw the Tory government last, you know, the last Tory government tried to bring in this thing where we're going to provide amnesty for people so that, you know, basically military personnel like Brigadier Gordon Kerr and others can't be prosecuted. And no political parties or political forces in Northern Ireland were prepared to accept that. Right across the spectrum, everybody said we're not having that. And it was basically because the Daily Mail were pushing, because there is now one of the soldiers from Bloody Sunday is on trial in Belfast, in Derry, for what happened all those years ago. And of course, there's a lobby that we don't want anybody to be prosecuted for any of that, blah, blah, blah. But of course, that's why the Tories brought in this thing, well, we'll have amnesty for everything, but nobody in Northern Ireland would accept that. The Protestant loyalists wouldn't accept it, the Republicans wouldn't accept it, the Alliance Party wouldn't accept it, the SDLP wouldn't accept it. Nobody wanted it. So one of the things that Blair Starmer did when he came to power, he said, well, we'll drop that because it's clearly nobody in Northern Ireland wants it. Now, of course, there's lots and lots of dead bodies buried in Northern Ireland, quite literally people in the bottom of a bog. So it's still not resolved. All of those things are still there and all the pain is still there on all sides.
Paul Holden mentioned there was this thing, Excalibur. Peter Mandelson's computer system called Excalibur. Apparently it was a way of keeping track of all MPs and MEPs that were in the Labour Party, and that they would pass around Excalibur records to selective journalists if they wanted to smear somebody.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. And, of course, the decision to make Mandelson the ambassador to the US has obviously blown up in their faces. But, of course, not many people are mentioning the obvious thing to say about Jeffrey Epstein is he worked for Mossad. And that is why Western politicians in the United States and elsewhere are supporting this genocide in Palestine, because they've basically been compromised by Mossad. They know very well what they've had sex with underage people and all stuff like that. Now, everybody know, and the dogs in the street know this, but that's the reality. And that's why they're not going to do anything to prevent what's going on with starvation and massacre, because you know they're all compromised.
Hugh Kerr is a former Labour MEP. Apparently, this system was used to rubbish him, and several Labour MPs told him how Mandelson had shown them that their Excalibur printouts and threatened them with action if they stepped out of line.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, the Labour Party is a bit like the Communist Party used to be in Poland or in many other countries. You have to be in it if you want to go in to get power, because that's the way the system is rigged, because of the first-past-the-post, which we've been stressing. And then, of course, once you get in, you can then be dealt with through the internal machinations of the apparatchiki, like Mandelson, who incidentally went to the same college as me at Oxford University, although he was a bit before I arrived.
Does that make any difference?
Well, no, I'm just saying that he was, you know...
What was he studying, do you know?
He studied PPE, like me.
Like you. How to manipulate the news and how to manipulate politics. Well,
It's the degree that people who want to go into politics do.
How to manipulate ideas. Is that what it's about?
Well, it was brought in 1918, because previously the people who ran the country tended to study Greek and Latin, which is kind of useful, but not really that useful. Economics and politics might be more useful going to run things.
Let's have a look at the bit to do with the Lib Dems and Labour now. I'm afraid we're going to hear from... This is another AI type. Do you remember Penny Morden, I think it was, that did that Stand Up and Fight, Stand Up and Fight, last year's Tory conference?
Yes, Elon Musk was demanding that people stand up and fight as well. Anyway, wave your flags and get ready to fight.
Let's have a listen to the tail end of Ed Davey, the Lib Dem leader's speech this week.
After the chaos and destruction of the Conservatives, amid the mistakes and disappointment of Labour, the failures and divisions of the SNP, and up against the dangers and lies of reform, we are in a battle for the very future of our country. And it's a battle we cannot afford to lose. So, if you believe in a Britain that stands proud for its values at home and abroad, if you believe in a Britain of growth and opportunity, fairness and prosperity, if you believe in a Britain that cares, join us. If you're fed up with the two old parties letting you down, if you're scared of the rise of racism and extremism, if you believe in decency, tolerance and the rule of law, join us. Because we believe in the British people, we love our country, and together we can change it for good. Thank you.
Well, they can hardly contain themselves. That's the Lib Dem leader, Ed Davey. He's sounding almost like flag waving there. I can see little pictures of English flags and Union Jack flags on lampposts as I'm listening to him talking about how to believe in Britain, how to be proud of Britain.
Well, I think the kind of people that go to Lib Dem conferences are not the kind of people who are putting up flags at the moment. They are trying to pitch to their...
So it's okay to be patriotic, but not the flag. There's something a bit funny
well,
here.
Well, no, there's no reason. The point is that the flag shouldn't be grabbed by one section of the community. As a means
but it
of
is. It's being grabbed by the pro-Israeli Tommy Robinson faction.
Well, that's right. So there you are. So it's not just British flags that they're waving. They're waving Israeli flags. They were waving Ukrainian flags previously. And, of course, a lot of the problem we've got is that Ukrainians just walked in here, even though they weren't part of the British Empire. They've got no visas. They just walked in, and they're the ones who are claiming loads and loads of benefits. In actual fact, they're coming mostly from the West Ukraine, where there was no real danger at all. Most of the people killed in the Ukraine were killed in the East Ukraine and were Russian speakers, and they fled to Russia. The ones who came here were under no danger at all, but they came in anyway, and they're taking your place in the hospital queue, Tony.
Well, in this Ukrainians. Week, in this week's poll, we were talking about Farage earlier and the collapse in the Labour vote. The Lib Dems are virtually no change at all. But anyway, let's just touch on this this flags business. What do you make of it, Martin? There's obviously some sort of... This is in the run-up to the rally a couple of weeks ago, the Tommy Robinson rally, and it was called the... I think it was Clive Lewis, MP, did a brilliant, I thought, brilliant report saying actually quite a lot of people who are going on this rally are not racist at all, but they're not interested in Tommy Robinson and his speeches. They're going on the rally because they just feel disenfranchised. They feel that the government is not patriotic anymore. They want to wave the flag, but the government doesn't.
Well, I wouldn't like to speculate on why everybody's there.
Did you read Clive Lewis's piece?
I didn't read it, no, but I saw
it. Well, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Okay. Well, I mean, the people that were there have obviously got their various reasons for being there. The Maori pro-Zionists are there because they're Maori pro-Zionists. You know?
They're not even British citizens,
they
were
they?
Not even announced. This is a bizarre... This is the way these things work. It's like a stage show, is that we're told this is about free speech, and it's also about uniting the country. And then when people turn up on the stage, there's Tommy Robinson shouting about how terrible Muslims are.
Well, that's right, because there's no actual, you know, if you turn up for something like that, you are cannon fodder, aren't you?
Yeah, but a lot of people are not interested in that. And I think the other thing is, if you're South Gloucestershire Council have made some sort of announcement, that's just round here, this week, about, well, we're going to take these flags down. But if you do that, surely what you're doing is you're saying, well, actually, we're giving up this whole idea of a flag and nationalism to the far right, to the racists.
The fact is that local bylaws make it clear that things like lampposts, for example, you need permission to put stuff on lampposts. Anybody needs permission. So if they go around and take it down, that's just council workers doing what council workers do. If we put up loads of Palestinian flags, they'd be taken down for exactly the same reason.
Israeli flags?
Israeli flags as well, because the rules about flags on lampposts. Now, if you put a flag on a lamppost, it's against the local bylaws. The council workers are going to come around and take it down, because nobody's allowed to put flags up on lampposts. Now, if we're going to have a rule that everybody can put...
What about on road bridges and motorway bridges?
Well, I mean,
I don't know.
You're certainly not allowed to...
You haven't actually answered my question, have you, about this idea of the flag. Is it by saying, no, you're not allowed to do this, are councils basically saying, well, these flags are now the territory of the far right and racists?
What they're doing is taking down... If I put up a thing for a rave on a lamppost, yeah? They take it down, because you're not supposed to.
Answer the question, will you?
The English flag, the St. George flag, was actually the flag of the New Model Army, okay? The New Model Army that chopped the head off the king, okay? That New Model Army. Does Tommy Robinson want to chop the head off the king? Because that's what that flag represented back in that era.
It was a court.
No, that's what the flag represented back in that era. English republicanism. Is Tommy Robinson a Republican? I'm a Republican.
Well, you're making my point for me. It's like the Robinson Brigade have decided, right, this is our flag. It's a pro-Israeli flag. It's an anti-Muslim flag. And it's a racist flag.
Did you watch the last night of the proms, Tony? Did you watch it? They played Rule Britannia, and all these people there, black and white, were waving those flags. Okay? That's the use of the flag when it's not being used to intimidate others. If I put up a flag outside your house, or where asylum seekers are or whatever, to say, go, I mean, somebody's actually abused the flag, he's written on the flag, get off my land. So he's written on the flag. You're not supposed to write on flags if you respect them.
Well, I'd be pretty annoyed if someone put an Israeli flag in my garden. That's true.
Well, that's right. So, and in Northern Ireland, of course, you couldn't fly the tricolour.
This is Britain. It's not Israel.
No, Britain is in Northern Ireland. The six counties are part of Britain. Until the 1980s, I think it was illegal to fly the Irish tricolour in Northern Ireland. You could be arrested. Okay? That's not the case now. But it took a lot of fighting.
I wonder what flags you're allowed to put up in China. Well, not many. I think if you were to put up the British flag in Hong Kong, there might be some questions about that.
Well, there you are. You see, this is the problem. Flags are, in fact, you know, what leads to conflicts. You know, flags are symbolic of conflicts.
Well, they can be, yeah.
I'm afraid they are. Yeah. The modern South African flag isn't the same as the old South African flag.
Also, a flag is also symbolic of the national identity, not necessarily conflict. But anyway, let's have a listen to the news item about this week.
Flags began going up at the start of August in towns and cities across England. Some were erected by organised groups, others by individuals like Lee, whose flags are donated by locals on his estate in Bristol.
It's because we want people to be proud to be British, yeah? Let's make a statement now. There's too many boats coming in, and this is no way I'm racist or nothing. We got to stand up and be proud. We're Great Britain for a reason, yeah?
In Birmingham, some of the flags have been up so long they've begun to look ragged, but many areas remain bedecked. Sabir Aziz says she and her friends feel uneasy about them, especially those who remember far-right attacks in the 70s and 80s.
For a lot of ethnic minorities, it's about checking in with how you're feeling when you're walking through an area that's saturated with flags and how it feels quite territorial and actually doesn't feel patriotic.
So far, local authorities have been reluctant to remove Union Jack and England flags. Derby could be the first council to do so from Monday, but it's already led to a row, and the councillor who made the announcement has said she's received death threats.
Well, look, they're doing it in South Gloucestershire too. But well, the guy there, the Bristolian guy, makes this point. I'm proud to be British, but I'm not racist. There's just too many boats.
Well, in other words, it's a political statement. Okay, so he wants that flag to represent, I don't like asylum seekers.
No, he's not saying that, is he? He's saying
there's too many boats.
Okay. And they're not all
how many
people
boats
on...
would be all right then?
Oh, I don't know. You better ask him.
Most English people came here on boats from Denmark in the 9th century.
For a long, long time, Martin, you seem to get this, but you don't get it anymore. Which is the idea that if you object to mass migration, that you must be a racist. This is your contention, isn't it?
No.
Yes, it is.
No. You can say I'm opposed to mass migration, and I'm going to...
Well, that's what he's
freedom
saying,
of speech,
it?
Tony. And
and you're calling him a racist.
I can call him anything I like. That's my right as an Englishman.
You're talking
nonsense. He says he isn't a racist. I say
he is. He is, because he's opposed to mass migration.
Okay.
But you're just twisting your going around in circles here.
I'm entitled to freedom of speech as well as him. Well, he can say whatever he likes, and I'm going to say what I like.
You're entitled to contradict yourself.
No, there's going to be a civil war. Elon Musk said so. Okay? I'm with Elon on
you believe Elon Musk, do you?
No. He spoke out, Tony. He's the richest man in the world. He said, civil war in our country. That's what he said.
Well, one of the things which might stop civil war is if we have got industry, but we don't. What do you make of this story this week about Jaguar Land Rover? I was looking at that thinking, well, they just aren't making any money, so they're using some cyber attack as an excuse to shut down.
There is going to be a depression. Not a recession, a depression. The car industry in this country is finished. It's all to do with blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by the Americans.
The car firm Jaguar Land Rover says some of its IT systems have been brought back online following a serious cyber attack at the end of last month, but production lines remain at a standstill and no new cars are being built. The government is looking at ways to help companies who supply JLR, some of which are running out of cash because of the stoppage. Here's our business correspondent Theo Leggett.
Jaguar Land Rover's computer networks have been shut down since the cyber attack at the end of August. This has paralysed its UK factories in Solihull, Halewood and Wolverhampton, as well as its overseas facilities. Now there are signs the situation could be easing. A few systems have now been brought back online, which should help the company to process invoices, supply spare parts to dealers and sell cars. However, production remains at a standstill, and concerns are growing about the health of companies in JLR's complex supply chain. Industry analysts say many may be close to bankruptcy. The government has been looking at ways in which they could be helped. Here's the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves.
The focus is both getting the business back up and running as quickly as possible, but also making sure, as a government, we're doing everything we can to stand by the company and the wider supply chain.
One option under consideration is the government itself buying parts from smaller suppliers in order to keep them operating and prevent them from running out of cash. However, firms the BBC spoken to say such a scheme would, on the face of it, be deeply impractical and ill-suited to an industry which relies on parts being delivered when and where they're needed, rather than being stockpiled.
Well, I mean, this reporter isn't looking into the possibility that actually the company is just going bust and this is all a load of nonsense and it's an excuse. Apparently, Martin, we hear yesterday from the FT that Jaguar Land Rover didn't have any insurance cover for cyber attack, and so it's going to have to pay for this cyber attack if it is indeed a cyber attack itself. But what do you make of the idea that maybe the company is just going bust, it can't pay its suppliers, so this is just an excuse?
Well, obviously, I've got no evidence either way, but the idea that what's going to happen going forward, in my view, is we're going to have a very, very hard time economically. And it doesn't really matter who the government is, because it's baked into the pie now. And it would be the same if Farage was in power tomorrow. The international, global international economy and Britain's role in it is dire, just dire. And that's because the Americans and the Israelis have basically deindustrialised this country and the rest of Europe in order to benefit themselves.
A very similar story this week.
Denmark's Prime Minister has spoken to NATO's Secretary General after drones forced the closure of some of the country's airports on two separate occasions this week. One airport was briefly shut down last night after a number of drones were sighted, and Copenhagen Airport was closed temporarily on Monday. Russia has described speculation it might have been involved as absurd. Here's our security correspondent Frank Gardner.
Last night's disruption by unauthorised drones to several Danish airports has been described by Denmark's Prime Minister as the most severe attack on Danish critical infrastructure to date. Police say the drones were launched locally by someone with professional knowledge. They posed a threat to aircraft taking off and landing. A hunt has begun for the perpetrators. Denmark has consulted with the head of NATO, Mark Rutte, as it considers following Poland and Estonia in triggering NATO's Article 4, which calls for joint consultation amongst allies when one country considers its security to be threatened. Suspicions immediately fell on Russia, although no evidence of its involvement has come to light. The Kremlin denied any involvement and hit back, calling it a staged provocation. But this latest incident follows a pattern of steadily escalating events. On Monday, unauthorized drones temporarily disrupted both Copenhagen and Oslo airports. Earlier this month, a fleet of around 20 Russian drones crossed well into Poland, another one crossed into Romania, and three Russian jet fighters made a sustained incursion into Estonian airspace. Taken together, this is all seen as deliberate probing of NATO's defences by Moscow.
I remember in 2018 we had a similar thing at Gatwick Airport, didn't we? They weren't blaming that on the Russians. So somebody somewhere is sitting there with a drone, sending it around an airport and shutting the airport down, Martin. Is it Putin?
No, obviously I don't know, but my guess is that this is Western intelligence services trying to ramp up, because we've got to spend loads and loads of money on new weaponry, Tony.
Apparently the first person you call is Mark Rutte.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is the
Secretary General of NATO.
That's right. So, in other words, my suspicion, I mean, what happened in Poland is the drones that came in were unarmed drones, first of all, and they were flown they were flown way out, they're way outside the war zone, and they haven't actually got the Russian drones that they're supposedly based on, haven't actually got the range to fly into Poland. Yeah. So what the stuff I've been reading suggests they were flied into Poland from Ukraine and made to look like Russian drones, because the people in Poland are beginning to wonder, why are we going to war with Russia? Because in actual fact, the Ukrainians are undercutting our farmers. We were talking about farmers earlier. Small farmers in Poland are being ruined by cheap imports from Ukraine, which isn't even in the EU, okay? But they've been allowed to bring that, which destroys Polish farming. They've got over a million refugees from Ukraine in Poland. Mostly, as I say, most of the refugees from Ukraine haven't come from the war zones. Yeah, the war zones are in the east. These are the people from the west who are taking the opportunity to move to the west. Yeah, because Ukraine's have been a basket case for years. And when the west said, you can come here, everybody went, yeah, and they just came. So they're going to be joining as Farage will, the Ukrainians are going to be here to stay now. And no doubt they will get British citizenship and they'll probably vote Tory. But there you go.
I think we've just got to put up. There is something to do with these drones and these cyber attacks, which the idea is it's impossible to trace them. So, but if you look at the trigger for a nuclear war, they are included. So it could be that the West does a cyber attack on itself, blames Russia, and starts a nuclear war.
Well, that is exactly what the Russians are saying. It's not in their interest to carry out pinprick attacks of this kind. It just isn't. Because all it does is it's a very deliberate attempt by the deep state in the West to keep the war in the Ukraine going, because they don't know what else to do.
Well, it's very convenient that British politics is in such paralysis, as these people are just playing about, basically the military starting World War III. Just before the break, though, let's have a listen to something I missed from a couple of weeks ago, which is the Conservative MP Danny Kruger. He did a rather nice speech about Christianity a few weeks ago, which we used on this programme at the very end of the show, but he has now decided that he's absolutely had it with the Tory party and he's off to reform.
I have been variously a member, an activist, an employee of the Conservative Party for over 20 years, and I have many friends in the party, many good and decent people, which is why it is so personally painful for me to be doing what I'm doing today. There have been moments when I've been very proud to belong to the Tory party. In 2010, I was inspired by the big society, by schools reform and welfare reform. I was thrilled by Brexit and by what Boris Johnson pulled off in 2019. But those were exceptions to the rule. The rule of our time in office was failure. Bigger government, social decline, low wages, high taxes, and less of what ordinary people actually wanted. And now our country is entering the most profound set of crises in my lifetime, under a government even worse, far worse, than the one it replaced. Crisis in the economy, crisis at the border, crisis in our streets, crisis in our military, crisis for young people. Yes, we are still a great country, and there are good reasons that so many migrants want to come here. But there are also reasons so many entrepreneurs and young people want to leave. Britain is not broken, but it is badly damaged. And so in this crisis, something's got to give. I hoped after our defeat last year that the Conservative Party would learn the obvious lesson, that the old ways don't work, that centrism is not enough, that real change is needed. But no, we've had a year of stasis and drift and the sham unity that comes from not doing anything bold or difficult or controversial. And the result is in the polls. And those lost voters aren't coming back.
So that's Danny Kruger. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Conservative MP for Devizes. I think it might be something part of Wiltshire now. was just chatting to Dave during that, pointing out that Devizes is actually quite a good, successful little town because it's only got a fairly small industrial estate on the outside of town, which is an out-of-town shopping place. But most of the town centre is where it all happens, and so it seems to be thriving there. But he's the first sitting Tory MP to defect to Reform, Martin. There'll probably be more, won't there?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I think it's rather interesting. He said, I've been a member of the Conservative Party and a member of Conservative governments for years and years and years.
20 years.
Yes, 20 years. And it's been 20 years of failure, so now I'm going to join Reform. Hang on a minute. For 20 years, you were in that government that you're claiming
No, he wasn't
failure.
In the government, was he? He was a backbencher.
I think he was in the government.
No, he's not been in the government, but Kruger, no. He's
I think you need to check MP. That.
Well, yeah, check it away, yeah. Yes. But he's not. He's not a government
All right,
minister.
But in any case, even as a backbencher, he supported those governments, didn't he? So everything that those governments did, he supported.
Yeah, but, you know, you're always so mean about people. He's like a bit like someone like David Davis, who's got a conscience and sits around on the back benches, actually making all sorts of trouble for the people in charge.
Well, it's not surprising that people of right-wing disposition like him are jumping ship from the Conservative Party, which is
Christian
clearly
or
the Titanic.
Right-wing. We're going to be talking a bit about Charlie Kirk, by the way.
Yes, we'll come
Everybody
to that.
Talks about Charlie Kirk as some sort of far-right person, activist. No, he's a Christian activist. And the same thing with people like Danny Kruger.
I don't care what kind of Christian he is, Tony. He's a Tory, and now he's a Reform MP.
Why
That's
don't we
fine.
Get any Christian Labour people?
You do. Alf Dubs, for example.
Who?
He's Lord Dubs now. There's plenty of Christian Labour MPs.
Well, there were people right. like Peter Shaw, well, people I'll, like Tony Benn. They're not anymore.
I'll be honest with you, Tony. That's not the big... Zara Sultana, I've got news for you. She isn't a Christian. No. She wouldn't be, would she? Why is being a Christian so important to you, Tony? Is that the only criteria on which you judge people? And maybe they say they're Christians, but they're not
maybe
really.
Maybe they are, yeah. But anyway, she is pro-trans, but she's supposedly Muslim.
Well, there you are.
Well,
so people
make
have got
sense,
lots of different views. And
it's
some
not
people
just
are Christians.
Different views.
Some people are Christians and they support Israel. Is Danny Kruger one of those Christians that supports Israel?
Well, maybe he is.
I think he probably
he
is. He's a Christian Zionist, isn't he?
He might be.
So the Zionism is more important than Jesus, then, isn't
maybe
it?
Maybe it is. Who
I think
knows?
It probably is.
Anyway, let's see what happens. And in fact, it's the same with most of the people in that Reform, I'm afraid. And the same with people in the Labour Party. But anyway, we're going to be talking, we're going to be hearing all about the death of Nasrallah. Was a neutron weapon used to kill Nasrallah in Beirut last year by the Israelis? After the break, we'll also be, of course, visiting some of the speeches that we haven't been hearing from the United Nations in New York.
This is the Time Radio Hour, the Bible edition. Last week we talked about Sid Nathan.
Give me the song.
Here's another little fact about him. He didn't just own King Records, he owned a music publishing company. And he loved getting more bang for his buck. He loved convincing the country music artists to record R&B songs, and vice versa. Wynonie Harris, who we heard a little while ago, recorded Hank Penny's Bloodshot Eyes. Both artists were on Nathan's King label. Another artist on Nathan's label was Reno and Smiley. They had a hit with their song, I'm Using My Bible as a Road Map. When Sid Nathan signed the four interns to King Records, he had them re-record, I'm Using My Bible. And they did it a little differently than the Reno and Smiley country style. Here's what it sounded like when Reno and Smiley did it.
I'm using my Bible for a road map. My last stop is heaven some sweet day.
And here's a slightly different version by the four interns. Give a listen. Take it away, Doctor.
Lord, I'm using my Bible for a road map. The Ten Commandments tell me what to do. The 12 disciples are my road signs. And Jesus will take me safely through. There'll be in heaven, and the whole rough road along the way. Yes, I'm using my Bible. Well, yeah, my last stop is heaven some sweet day. Well, I know I'll see along the way many sinners who have gone astray.
hitchhikers along the roadside. But I know it's the devil in disguise. I know I may run out of gas, but the power of love. For a road map, the children of Israel used it too. You know they caused the Red Sea of destruction. Oh God, was there to see them through. Well, we know these Jews, yeah, on the rough road along the way. Yes, from using my Bible.
I'm using my Bible for a roadmap by the four interns. Thank you.
Lovely giant pig floating over the wonderful Battersea coal-fired power station. That's 1977. Absolutely love that. That whole album is almost like Pink Floyd. I always remember John Snow, the Channel 4 News journalist, editor, whatever. He wasn't an editor, no. He was a correspondent, I suppose, and presenter, saying how MI5 had approached him to be an agent for them or work for them with them. And he said, no, journalists should never do that. And at the same time, he was talking about the sorts of music that they liked. And he was saying, no, I'm a Pink Floyd man myself, and so am I. So that is from 1977, the album Animals. That's Sheep by Pink Floyd. Before that, you heard Theme Time Radio Hour from Bob Dylan with Sid Nathan. I'm using my Bible as a road map. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll be looking now at, particularly, I think, at this attack by, well, the work by Dr. Chris Busby, which I would say is particularly, I mean, what annoys me is it's not reported. Even if there are problems with it, it should be reported. The reason that a lot of the mainstream news outlets don't report what Chris Busby is saying is not because he is not one of the most well-respected around the world scientists. It's because of a certain person called Mr. George Monbiot, who wrote a massive hatchet job on Chris not long after Fukushima And Chris had discovered that there were cancer clusters around nuclear power stations. Chris was a big threat to the nuclear industry. He is also, rather like we heard Marianne Birkby from Radiation Free Lakeland, having gone away from much of the environmental or so-called environmental movement. And in fact, it's a bit like JFK, RFK Jr., isn't it, saying that the Republican Party went away from me. Well, the environmental movement... the Democratic Party's gone away from me.
He's in the Republican Party now.
Yeah, well, is he?
Well, of course, he's representing.
I don't know that he's actually. He is, but I don't know if he's actually in the Republican Party. But anyway, so the point here is, where was I? The point here is that the nuclear industry or the various campaign groups seem to have all slowly but surely migrated over to become pro-nuclear, or we don't say anything about nuclear. This is the ones that are supposed to be against it. Anyway, the point is. The work that Chris Busby's been doing recently has been presenting more evidence, and I'll put up full links on the show page at thisweek.org.uk, not just to his little thing he did on YouTube, but also to the research papers on ResearchGate and elsewhere that he's put up. It's explaining that this is very weird, this enriched uranium appearing and other chemical... other isotopes of different elements appearing in the dust of the bombed buildings in Beirut where the Hezbollah chief Nasrallah was killed. And what he's suggesting here is, and it's pretty clear, that there was some sort of neutron weapon, a nuclear weapon was used alongside the conventional weapons. So what they do is they... We'll send a missile in, which will make a great big hole, and at the bottom of that hole, their little neutron weapon gets down there, and another weapon goes off, which will basically fry everybody using neutrons. So it's a fascinating concept. It should be being looked at around the world, of course, but I'm afraid it isn't. Rather like Todd Ryder and his work on the origins of nuclear weapons delivery systems and the weapons themselves, including thermonuclear weapons, all being developed, and the atom bomb twice even possibly being tested by the Nazis before the end of the Second World War. So lots and lots to do with nuclear technology, of course, is being kept secret. But let's have a listen to Chris now explaining something of the nuclear physics behind why he's saying that he thinks a neutron weapon may well have been used to kill Hassan Nasrallah by the Israelis last year in Beirut.
Lead has a number of different isotopes. It has its isotopes that have lead 204, lead 206, lead 207, and lead 208. These are the standard isotopes you find if you dig lead out of the ground. And they vary to some extent depending upon the amount of, the amount of uranium because they're all the final products of uranium decay. So there is a sort of ratio that you can find in nature. And the same with mercury. Mercury, the isotopes are 200, 201, and 202. And with cadmium, there's 110, 111, 112, 13, and 14. So these are different isotopes of the same element. But the point is that in nature, the isotopic ratios are pretty fixed. And even with the lead isotopes, they're fixed over a certain region. But what we found when these samples were analyzed, and there were two samples from close to where the bomb fell. They were dust samples. They were picked up with a Hoover, with a little vacuum cleaner, one of those things that you clean out a car with, a battery-operated vacuum cleaner. And I have to say it's quite hard to get these because the site was controlled by Hezbollah, and they're quite tough guys in Beirut. You know, you have to be quite careful because they'll arrest you and throw you in jail and so on. So we enlisted support. We had some support from a woman there called Yvonne, who's a reporter, and she helped us get the samples. And then, as I said, they were all smuggled out as coffee and all the rest of that stuff, resulting in the death of poor Robert, unfortunately. But there we are. So what this shows is it shows scientifically that the lead and the mercury and the cadmium in the samples were exposed to neutrons, to quite a high level of neutron exposure. Because what happens when you expose an isotope to a neutron is it changes its atomic mass. So, for instance, lead-206 goes to lead-207 when you add a neutron. Lead-207 goes to lead-208 if you add a neutron. Lead-206 goes to lead-208 if you add two neutrons, and so on. And the same at cadmium. So we were looking at cadmium 111 and cadmium 114. Now, normally in nature, cadmium 111 is about 12.8% of all cadmium. And 114 is 28.8% of all cadmium. But when we looked at the samples, we found that instead of being 12.8% and 28%, it was about 12.8 and 12.8. So in other words, the cadmium 114 had absorbed neutrons and turned into whatever it turns into. I think thallium. Is it thallium anyway? Another element. So, and the same with lead. So for each one of these things, for the lead, the heaviest isotope, the 208, disappeared. And for the mercury, the heaviest isotope, which is 202, that disappeared. And for cadmium, the heaviest isotope, 114, disappeared relative to 111. Now, this is an extraordinarily important finding, because this is for the first time scientific proof that the bomb that produced that material was a neutron bomb, that there was a high neutron flux. And that, of course, explains the death of Nasrallah, because neutrons go through concrete. You can't hide from neutrons. That's why neutron bombs were invented, because you can get inside a cellar and you have meters of concrete between you and the bomb, and the bomb blast can't hurt you, and the gamma radiation can't hurt you, but the neutrons go straight through the concrete and kill you. And we heard from various people who were reporting about Nasrallah's death is that he was found pretty much intact, but dead. And this is something gets found again and again in reports that doctors send from Lebanon and from Gaza, that people appear to be dying of diseases that they haven't seen before. Not diseases, but conditions that they have not seen before and they're unable to explain.
Okay, well, how do neutrons kill you then?
They kill you in the same way as radiation kills you. They cause ionization in tissue. Neutrons are absorbed by low atomic number elements like hydrogen. I mean, it is hydrogen that stops neutrons. Neutrons actually hit hydrogen and cause ionization. So it's pretty much the same way that all ionizing radiation works. And in fact, neutrons are included in the list of types of ionizing radiation. In terms of the Hiroshima bomb, you get lots of neutrons from nuclear bombs, you see, from conventional nuclear bombs. These are the ones that produce fallout, produce cesium-137 and, all that stuff that causes Geiger counters to go mad. And neutrons won't be detected by Geiger counters, because a Geiger counter doesn't contain material that the neutrons are concerned about. It goes straight through the Geiger counter and it won't show any signal at all. In order to show a signal, you have to have a special detector which has low atomic number, like lithium or beryllium or something like that. And then what happens is that the neutrons hit the lithium and knock an alpha particle out of it. And what you measure is the alpha particle. So right. They kill you in the same way.
Yeah, but is it a quick death? Is it would he have died slowly? How does it?
No, no. Yeah, what it does is it. Well, yes, that's a very interesting question, and the answer to that, as far as I can make out, is that it kills you instantly, and it does so by destroying your nervous system. I mean, so in other words, it pretty much smashes up everything. But your nervous system is rather important, because you use it to breathe. And to think and all sorts of other things that happen inside bodies, and neutrons just stop those. If you've got high enough neutron flux, what happens is that you just die.
Now, I'd imagine that other scientists, maybe Israeli scientists from Dimona, might say, well, there are other explanations for this imbalance that you've discovered in these different isotopes.
Well, they'd have to say it, but there isn't. That it's just physics. I mean, there is no The only possible explanation for the lead imbalance would be that if there was no thorium-232, so because the lead isotopes are daughter elements at the end of the series of the three natural decay series, so that you've got three natural decay series on Earth, and that's uranium-238 series, the uranium-235 series, which they call the actinide series, and the thorium-232 series. So each one of these has a decay, and it goes another decay, and then there's another decay, and another decay, and another decay, and another, over various long periods of time, thousands of years. And, well, more than that, actually, hundreds of thousands of years. But the end product of each of these series is a different lead isotope. And the lead isotope that is the end of the thorium-232 series is lead-208. So if you dig up some mud and you find that there's hardly any lead-208 there, the only possible explanation is that there was no thorium-232 there to begin with. But I followed that up because I looked at the concentrations of thorium-232 actually it's pretty much normal throughout the globe, but certainly there's a paper or number of papers that show that the thorium-232 levels in Lebanon are pretty normal. So that's not an explanation. The only other explanation, of course, is that somebody brought some material from a nuclear waste site. But then that would have lots and lots of other stuff in it as well. You know, you can't sort of bring just the lead isotopes from a nuclear waste site. The other explanation is that it's material that's been exposed to neutrons somewhere else. For instance, like if they dug up a load of soil right outside a nuclear reactor, it would have various perturbations in the lead. But this isn't the same. This isn't true for the mercury and the cadmium. The cadmium isotope ratios are pretty much constant. They have a variation of less than 1% in all cadmium isotope. Isotope ratios found on Earth.
Have you had other scientists in other parts of the world looking at this and assessing it, Chris?
Well, it's only just come out. That's the first thing. I mean, I only released the. I sat on this data for a month or two because I was afraid to be murdered. Okay? I mean, this is hot stuff, and you know. They killed poor Robert, and I'm hiding out in the forest in Latvia, you know, surrounded by a guinea fowl, and hope that nobody's going to kill me, because the people who killed Robert are really, you know, quite serious people. And various other people have died who have drawn attention to this issue of the neutron bomb. I mean, there are a number of deaths along the road. The man who wrote the book about the original book about it called The Mystery of the Three Bullets, that guy, he's dead. And the other guy who wrote it with him was sent three bullets in the mail and then he disappeared. So I can't get in touch with him. But to answer your question, I can tell you that a friend of mine sent the paper to his physics tutor, Oxford. And the physics tutor, Oxford, said he thought about it for a bit. And he got back and said he's not going to make any comments on it because it's secret stuff. It has to do with, you know, government secrecy. So that's the most that I know about it. But I've sent it to other scientists who say, yeah, sure. A number of scientists that I know, physicists that I know, said, look, this is perfectly clear that this shows neutron exposure effects. Now, we don't know how it works. We don't entirely know how the bomb works. We've got, you know, the device. We've got a sort of idea about it, which we got initially from Emilio Della Guidici, who's was quite a famous physicist, but he's dead. He died suddenly too. And he actually visited me in London. We had a meeting in Paddington in 2006, in which he told me how this thing worked. So we have a rough idea how it worked, but how it produces these alterations in the isotopic ratios, we haven't figured out. Mm. I mean, you can do a bit of arm waving, but I don't know enough about, this is high energy atomic physics. I've no doubt there are people who can do this, but I'm not one of them.
All so I mean, let's just imagine a kind of cannon style bomb where you use conventional explosives to get some kind of nuclear device into deeper into the ground. So is that what we're looking at here? So some yes, way of penetrating the ground, and then something else happens. In other words, the shell kind of goes into the ground and then explodes as it gets down with this neutron effect.
Yes, I think we're looking at something like that. But when I look at the whole picture, going back over my own work on this over 20 years, I realize that I'm an idiot, you know. I realize that actually this stuff's been used for a long, long time. You know, this is nothing new. It's just that what's new is that we've discovered it. But before that, you know, it was being used all over the place. For example, I talked to Saud al-Azawi, who is quite a famous or well-known Iraqi scientist, woman. Last week I talked to her because I'm doing a study in Iraq on uranium effects in southern Iraq, cancer and so forth. And I talked to her because she studied this as well. And she did a load of measurements of uranium in Iraq long ago, before the Second Gulf War. And if you look at her results, which she sent to me, you find that there's enriched uranium in Iraq before the Second Gulf War. And you think, excuse me, Guten Morgen. So this weapon was used long ago. It's been used long ago. She said to me that she thought that this was the weapon that was used to kill all of Saddam's his guards who were defending the Baghdad airport at the time of the Second Gulf War, because they were all found in their trenches dead. But there was no reason for them being dead. And people who at the time who I met and told me about this when I was in Malaysia, talking about uranium, they told me that the report was that there were a lot of big flashes, and then the next day all of these people in their dugouts, you know, sheltered behind concrete, were dead, but with no apparent reason for them being dead. So I think this is a tunable weapon, and it's pretty much like Del Guida, she said, you know, you can make, once you've got the technology, you can produce as many neutrons as you like, or you can produce no neutrons. You can make anything from just an ordinary DU bullet that goes bam through a tank to something like a sort of super DU bullet that contains hydrogen and burns its way through the tank and produces neutrons. Or you can make something pretty much close to a nuclear weapon, which I think is what Israel has done and is what they're using. And it drives the coach and horses through all of these nuclear bomb treaties that everybody has signed all over the place.
It's not just that, is it? What we keep hearing about is the inspections of Iran and their civil nuclear program, but we don't hear anything about the Israelis. But look, there's another development also this week, Chris, which is to do with underground dumping. Ed Miliband is poised to overrule local opposition to build nuclear waste dumps in Cumbria, particularly. I mean, this surely it's been going on for decades, this threat to sort of tunnel down, a bit like the BBC series The Edge of Darkness, and to sort of get waste into the ground and then just basically seal it up and forget about it, rather than to have it contained on the surface and to deal with it like that. So it looks as if Miliband is going to be pushing this ahead, with saying, well, actually, even if the locals don't want it, then we're going to do it anyway.
Well, I know an awful lot about the disposal of nuclear waste in this way, because I was commissioned by the Swedish anti-nuclear people to write a big report about the Forsmark repository, which actually has been allowed to go ahead now. And there was a big court case, which I was involved in as well, in Stockholm, in the Nacka court, the Nacka environmental court, in which we argued that what they were proposing was astonishingly awful and dangerous, you know. But in fact, in the end, what happened in Sweden is that the government overruled the findings of the Nacka court. The environmental court said, you can't do this. And they said, well, stuff you, we're going to go ahead and do it. So they overruled the NACA court. And so they're building this exact repository, the one that Miliband is talking about, out under the Baltic Sea, near the Forsmark site in Sweden, north of Uppsala. So, the answer is that they mustn't do this. I mean, what can we say? All we can do is bleat, and all the local people can bleat and do bleat. And the government, like in England, just like the government in Sweden, can just go ahead and say, well, stuff you, we're going to do it.
But it's got to go somewhere, surely.
It stays where it is. It's packaged and repackaged and repackaged. The nuclear free local authorities think that. I suggested that long ago when the question came up. Is that all you can do with this stuff? I mean, I made a video about it, God knows how long ago. Is that all you can do with this stuff is to repackage it. So you just leave it above ground in a sort of big hangar. You guard it so nobody can steal it. I don't know why anybody would want to. And then you just, if it looks like it's going to leak, you put another package around the package. And my suggestion, which I thought rather entertaining at the time, and I still believe this is the best way, is to actually have people who are given a job, you know, and you could say it's a job that goes down through time. So your son gets it and his son gets it and so on. And you call yourselves guardians of the nuclear waste, and you get a special outfit, you know, with sort of badges and stuff like that and golden buttons. And people say, do you know Jim? Jim's father is a guardian of the nuclear waste. And he said, no, surely not. Oh, yes, yes. And he gets a lot of money, and he's got this uniform, and he walks about guarding the nuclear waste. I think that's the only safe way to do it. Once you stick it in the ground, all sorts of things happen. I mean, I had a geology friend, a professor, what was he called? Niels Morgan something. He's dead now. In Sweden, he said that you get geological movements which will destroy any attempt to keep this stuff from the environment once you've buried it. I mean, over geological timescales, there are movements which will destroy any integrity to this sort of nuclear site.
So if Miliband was with us now, Chris, what would you have to say to him?
I would say you're an ignoramus. I'd say the problem with people like you is that you're politicians and you just don't know any science. And what you do is you surround yourselves with scientists who work for the nuclear industry and idiots, and they will tell you what it is you want to know.
And whereabouts are groups like Friends of the Earth on all this?
Well, Friends of the Earth were behind the work that I did in Sweden. I don't know what Friends of the Earth are doing now, and I don't know what Greenpeace is doing now. Those people, Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace, I have no time for them. All they do is they ask people for money.
That's an interesting place to stop. But that's not the end of the interview. The full version of that will be up on our show page later this evening at thisweek.org.uk. So, Martin, he's really, I mean, the two completely separate topics, obviously related through nuclear and nuclear weapons. What do you think of the possibilities that these sorts of weapons are being used? The Israelis, we know, are very, very interested in at the forefront of the use of and development of nuclear weapons through their Dimona site. They were very, very keen to get their hands on them. They're always accusing the Iranians of having nuclear weapons. Maybe they are actually using them, never mind accusing other people of having weapons they haven't got.
Well, that's right. I mean, he's obviously a very knowledgeable guy, and of course we've interviewed him, or you've interviewed him previously, saying that they've got samples from Gaza to show that they've been using neutron bombs.
Yeah, and he's quite happy to admit that maybe there is a problem with the chain of custody, bringing this stuff from the bomb site in Lebanon to him. But he's saying, well, what you need is a different explanation because of these various other elements which have got isotopes that you wouldn't normally expect to find. You've got to have an explanation for that too.
Yeah, and I think if it was going to be in a court of law, they would say, well, you haven't got a chain of custody. Incidentally, there was no chain of custody for the chemical weapons at Douma, and there was no chain of custody for Novichok and Skripal. So, in other words, you know, the fact that there's no chain of custody is not, in one sense, neither here nor there.
I mean,
there.
The weapons that are available to be used, we know, don't we, that they're probably decades ahead of what we're told.
That's right, and of course the Israelis have got, you know, if what he's saying about the first after the first Gulf War is true, what it is they're experimenting with this stuff without telling anybody what they're doing, because that's what military-industrial complexes do, just to see what happens if they do it. And that seems entirely plausible to me. They're not trustworthy in any way, shape or form. It's quite the sort. And, of course, the beauty of it is that it kills people and they don't even know that they're dying, because, you know, with the Israelis, they actually want to wipe the Palestinians out. So by using things like neutron weapons, they are damaging the genetic code of children, for example, so that they can't, in fact, bear healthy children. And that is definitely part of their program. They just want these people gone.
Yeah, so like I say, the full version of that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I'll put some links also up to Chris's scientific report on that, where he goes through some of the nuclear physics science around why he thinks what he thinks. Also, the longer version of the interview I did with Marianne Birkby of Radiation Free Lakeland, all about this new whiz idea of Ed Miliband, which is to dig a great big hole and put all the high-level nuclear waste in there. Maybe then he'll go to another country and go off somewhere and leave that to the Brits. All seems to me to be part of destroying the environment. Nothing to do with a minister of the environment. It's not the sort of thing an environment minister would do. But we also, I think, have to connect this up with big international politics, Martin, because the Israelis, if they are using these weapons, neutron weapons, they are constantly accusing the Iranians, aren't they?
Well, they are, and of course, you know, this is a basic thing. If the Israelis are allowed to have nuclear weapons, they're not, in fact. If they openly said, we've got nuclear weapons, the Logan Act would kick in, and therefore there would have to be automatic sanctions on the country. Now, the whole world knows that they've got at least 200 nuclear warheads there. And, of course, if they've got nuclear warheads, and look how belligerent and arrogant they are, it's quite likely that other countries in the region are going to say, well, we're going to have nuclear weapons just to keep you in the box. The Iranians haven't done that. They've basically said all along, we don't want nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, if they withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty, which they might do, then of course they're absolutely within their rights to have nuclear weapons. If the Israelis have got them, why can't we have them?
Well, what about,
why can't everybody have them?
What about this idea of accusation being a confession? I do wonder if that's exactly what's going on here. If the Israelis know what they're doing is wrong, and using these illegal weapons, these nuclear weapons, this neutron weapon, but so what they're doing in order to try and preempt the debate is to accuse Iran of using and developing these sorts of weapons themselves. This is this idea that an accusation is a confession. It's very much like this, where they're saying it's all these countries want to exterminate Israel whilst they're exterminating Gaza.
Well, indeed. And, of course, the other thing is that it's not really about Iranian nuclear weapons at all. It's about regime change. So it's just an excuse to beat them over the head with. It's a useful baseball bat with nails in.
Yeah. We've had the United Nations Security Council this week. I was rather horrified to see that certain people are being covered 100%, like Netanyahu, on the British media, and not others. So let's have a listen now to a clip from the speech by the Iranian president, Pezeshkian. He's there over in New York and speaking about, basically about their take on what's going on. And they want to have a very peaceful world. They're finding it very difficult, but they're still persisting, apparently.
A future not in pursuit of peace imposed by force, but founded upon strength derived through peace. In such a strong region, slaughter and bloodshed shall find no place. It is for this very reason that my country has, for many years, been among the staunchest advocates of establishing a region free of weapons of mass destruction. Yet those who themselves possess the largest nuclear arsenals and who, in flagrant breach of the NPT make their weapons even deadlier and more destructive, have for years subjected our people to pressures on the basis of spurious allegations. Last week, three European states, having failed through a decade of bad faith and thereafter by supporting military aggression to bring the proud people of Iran to their knees, at the behest of the United States of America, sought by means of pressure, coercion, imposition, and manifest abuse to reinstate against Iran the Security Council resolutions that had already been terminated. In doing so, they set aside good faith. They circumvented legal obligations. They sought to portray Iran's lawful remedial measures taken in response to the United States' withdrawal from the JCPOA and to Europe's breach and utter incapacity as a gross violation. They falsely presented themselves as parties of good standing to the agreement, and they disparaged Iran's sincere efforts as insufficient. All of this was in pursuit of nothing less than the destruction of the very JCPOA, which they themselves had once held as the foremost achievement of multilateral diplomacy. This unlawful measure, which has also met the opposition of certain members of the Security Council, possesses no international legitimacy and will not garner the approbation of the international community. I hereby declare once more before this assembly that Iran has never sought and will never seek to build a nuclear bomb. We do not seek nuclear weapons. This is our belief based on the edict issued by the supreme leader and by religious authorities. Therefore, we never sought weapons of mass destruction, nor will we ever seek them. Whereas those who disturb the peace and stability in the region lies in Israel, but Iran is the one that is being punished for those actions. There is a poem that roughly says something to the effect that someone in one side of the world does something to disturb the peace and someone else is punished for those actions. Ladies and gentlemen, the Islamic Republic of Iran welcomes peace and stability. We believe that the future of our region and of the world must be built upon cooperation, trust, and shared development. In this framework, Iran supports the peace process between the Republic of Azerbaijan and the Republic of Armenia in hopes that its outcome shall be enduring and serve as a foundation for improved relations between these two neighboring states. Iran also hopes that the efforts to bring an end to the war in Ukraine may result in a just and lasting agreement between Russia and Ukraine and bring solace to the human suffering caused by this crisis. Iran welcomes the defensive pact between the two brotherly Muslim countries, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, as a beginning for a comprehensive regional security system with the cooperation of the Muslim states of West Asia in the political, security, and defense domains. Finally, Iran condemns the criminal aggression of the Israeli regime against Qatar, which resulted in the martyrdom of a number of Palestinian and Qatari nationals, and declares its support and solidarity with the government and people of Qatar. Ladies and gentlemen, true security is not achieved through force, but through confidence-building, mutual respect, regional convergence, and multilateralism grounded in international laws.
So that's the president of Iran. He's saying that peace and security is achieved through trust and peacemaking rather than threats.
Well, we can't have that, Tony. I mean, it's just right out of line, isn't it? I mean, obviously, we need the Israelis and the West to dominate everything and everybody else just do as they're told, surely.
He seems quite sort of calmly putting all this stuff across. It must be quite frustrating being in Iran and being accused of all these things, being bombed by the Americans, etc., whilst you're... You know, is it possible to negotiate with somebody who, in the middle of negotiations, decides, right, we're going to bomb them?
Well, I think that's an obvious question to ask, isn't it? The Israelis have killed the government of Yemen. They killed all the top people in Yemen. They killed loads and loads of top people in Iran. And as we were hearing earlier, they killed what Nasrallah was doing was talking with his lieutenants about a peace proposal from the Americans. So the Americans set up the hit. They know where they're discussing the peace proposal. It's exactly, I mean, the Hamas people were in Qatar because Trump had said, go to Qatar and talk to the people. And then as soon as you know where they are, you whack them. which is what the Russians did with Dudayev back in the day. He was the president of Chechnya.
In the 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. They said Yeltsin agreed to talk to him. So this is before mobile phones. They used satellite phones. So he picked up the satellite phone to talk to Yeltsin, and then the Russians put a missile on and killed him. Now, if you are talking to people who use those techniques, and the Israelis and the Americans certainly do, then you, at a certain point you say, well, we're not going to talk to
you. And the Russians...
Yeah, well, we're not of course, yes, Putin was attacked by the Ukrainians, wasn't he? With a drone swarm while he's talking.
The Russians use these techniques, as you've just explained.
Well, no, the Russians of that era used those techniques. Yeltsin was working with the West at that stage, yeah? The point is, anybody can do that. The Romans used to do that. Back in the day, they would invite barbarians to a big feast, and the barbarians would come to the feast, and then they'd kill them all. But, of course, if you're a barbarian, you might get a bit wise to that, you know. Beware of Roman feasts.
Yeah, so the Iranians are the obvious people to listen to. But what about Colombia? There's been some political changes there, haven't there?
Well, in recent years, Gustavo Petro became the first left-wing president ever of Colombia. And, of course, there's been a massive civil war in Colombia, since civil war seems to be one of the things we're talking about this evening, in which millions of people have been displaced, at least 7 or 8 million, and hundreds of thousands have been killed. But, of course, what's happened now is we've got a left-wing government, but, of course, the army, police, and they've got plenty of US military bases there. Petro, you know, they are hoping that they can get rid of him, just as they're trying to get rid of Maduro. We haven't discussed any of this, all the people have been killed. Did you see J.D. Vance was saying, if I was a fisherman in Venezuela, I wouldn't be going to sea at the moment, because they're killing fisher folk along the borders of Venezuela.
Well, they say they're smuggling and then killing them.
But it's like J.D. Vance said, if I was a fisherman, I wouldn't be going to sea. Just like a Gaza fisherman, they can't go to sea because they're going to be killed by the Israelis.
Well, I think this the thing about Latin Americans know what the USA is like.
The gringos.
Well, that's right. Anyway, so let's have a listen to this Colombian president at the UN this week.
It is our differences that... compels us to coordinate our action at the global level. Dialogue, yes. Humanity, yes. Humanity, profoundly democratic, yes. Hopefully, a humanity of based on leaders who are free, rather than a humanity that is basically slaves, just a beast of burden. A humanity that shoots missiles against young people, our defenseless armed people, or shoots missiles in a place of the world near where Jesus was born. These problems cannot be resolved with governments who are bribed by oil producers, by oil corporations. So a new political subject is emerging, a united and diverse humanity, united despite its diverse cultures. Meanwhile, the old societies of Europe are collapsing, and the United States is applauding its new Hitler. It's not listening to its own young people or its older people who died in Europe in the battlefields of Europe fighting against Hitler and against his criminal ideology. Today, the same thing is being done as Hitler did, building concentration camps for migrants. It's stated that migrants are of an inferior race, and they blame them, just like Hitler blamed the Jews. They call them drug traffickers and thieves, whereas the majority of drug traffickers are blonde and have blue eyes, and they keep their fortunes in the largest banks in the world. They don't live in Bogota or in Gaza. They live in Miami. They are neighbors of President Trump. They live in Dubai or in Paris or London. They don't live where there's poverty. But the missiles are fired against those where there's poverty.
Well, that's Gustavo Petro. Petro means stone, so Mr. Stone. His election.
Colombian president.
Yes, he was originally.
A breath of fresh air, I'd say.
Yes, indeed. Yes, and he was originally a guerrilla in M19, which is one of the left wing guerrilla forces in Colombia. And he replaced the previous right wing liberal party regimes, who were basically running death squads, massacring. I went to Colombia in 2005 on a trade union delegation, and the trade union and social movements were under a massive repression. People were killed while we were there. We went round to the headquarters of their National Union of Mine Workers, glass everywhere, because there'd been a bomb attack the previous day. That's what was going on. People were dying all the time. And of course, his election has been a great victory for the left in Colombia after years and years and years of brutal repression. But of course, the structure of the state isn't entirely in his hands. The army and the intelligence services are aligned with the US. The US has got several bases in Colombia. And of course, they're now talking, you can see that we haven't, we mentioned it earlier, but there's a big strike force been assembled off the coast of Venezuela, and they're going to try and remove the Maduro government. The elected government of Venezuela is about to, they're trying to remove them.
So we haven't heard from Lavrov yet. I've been actually refreshing the United Nations YouTube channel in a sad fashion, seeing when is Lavrov going to appear, or we're going to hear from the Russians at the UN. I think that's going to be an interesting one. So that could happen later on this evening, or should at some point. But Zelensky certainly popped up from Ukraine, and he, a couple of days ago, the BBC reported on some of his speech, and we'll hear a little clip from him now as part of a BBC report.
President Zelensky has warned that Russia will keep driving the war in Ukraine wider and deeper unless President Putin is stopped. He told the United Nations General Assembly that peace depended on the delegates and urged them not to stay silent while Russia, as he put it, kept dragging out the war. The Ukrainian leader said the conflict was leading to a dangerous escalation in weapons technology.
Dear leaders, we are now living through the most destructive arms race in human history, because this time it includes artificial intelligence. And if there are no real security guarantees except friends and weapons, and if the world can't respond even to old threats, and if there is no strong platform for international security, will there be any place left on earth that's still safe for people?
So that's another one the BBC is reporting. Some of them they don't, but Zelensky obviously they do. Is he just working for MI6, Martin, this guy?
Well, he's very close to them. He's an agent of influence, is what I'd say about his relationship with MI6.
He's not really president either.
Well, no, there was supposed to be an election in May, but he cancelled it. The Russians, of course, went ahead with their presidential election, and Putin won convincingly. Zelensky didn't have a presidential election because it's likely he would lose. So that's why he didn't have one, which means why the Russians are saying, well, we can't really talk to him, because unless you've had an election, you're not actually the president of Ukraine. Yeah, we're not recognising your regime.
I'm not sure if it's Glenn Deason or Dialogue Works. There's some really good stuff around about...
He's very good.
He interviewed this chap called General Harald Kujat, who's a former head of the German army, this week, talking about the Ukraine, what he says the lies in the Ukraine war. And of course, the German army should know.
There are two aspects that could lead to an escalation, both in the past and in the future. One aspect originates from Ukraine. Since Ukraine is very weakened on the military front and maintaining its defense is practically no longer possible, only delaying actions are essentially taking place there. For this reason, Ukraine has long been trying to escalate in other areas and thus draw NATO into this war. For example, through attacks on the nuclear strategic early warning system, attacks on Russia's nuclear strategic bomber fleet, or even attacks on nuclear power plants. These are attempts to elevate this war to another level, specifically to the level between the U.S. and Russia, and thus to expand this war. The other aspect concerns the intentions, particularly those coming from the Europeans. It is repeatedly said that we must enable Ukraine to use weapons effectively deep inside Russia In other words, to give it a strategic perspective. The key term here is the German Taurus system. And that would essentially mean that the Europeans would be taking the step from indirect involvement in this war to direct involvement. However, I believe the Europeans are very much aware that without the support of the United States, this would be an undertaking that would lead to an expanded European war and the destruction of this continent.
Und zu einer Zerstörung dieses Kontinents. Ich hoffe, dass Sie sich jedenfalls darüber im Klaren sind.
I hope you are at least aware of that. That is why I am watching these efforts by the so-called Coalition of the Willing with great concern, as they keep trying to get a foot in the door, so to speak, whether in connection with a peace treaty or a ceasefire, fully aware that Russia would never accept the deployment of troops from NATO countries in Ukraine. That is precisely the approach Russia has pursued from the very beginning. Ukraine, as its constitution stipulates, is supposed to be a neutral, non-aligned state without nuclear weapons. No foreign troops are to be stationed on Ukrainian territory. Those are essentially the key points.
Das sind die Kernpunkte eigentlich. Also was man erreichen will, ist eben diese.
So what is being aimed for is precisely this large buffer zone between NATO and Russia, so that escalation does not occur due to technical failure or human error, which would then be politically uncontrollable. This situation was similar recently in connection with the drones over Poland. In that case, the response was not what it should be in a crisis situation, seeking contact, trying to clarify the situation, establishing facts, but rather as a kind of Pavlovian reflex, it was immediately declared to be a provocation or even an attack. In this context, I also want to point out another issue, the risk of being drawn into this war.
In diesen Krieg hineingezogen zu werden, jetzt auch im Zusammenhang mit dieser Drohnengeschichte hat.
Now, also in connection with this drone incident, the Ukrainian president has once again said that preventive measures must be taken to prevent something like this from happening. And the proposal that came up at the beginning of the war, to establish a no-fly zone over western Ukraine, has resurfaced. A no-fly zone would mean a direct conflict between NATO, or the countries establishing this no-fly zone, and Russia. One must be clear about that. This has all been discussed before, but it keeps coming up. And the other question is, how could it happen that Europeans, so to speak, stumble or slide into this war with a situation developing that can no longer be controlled?
So that's Harold Kujat, interviewed by Glenn Deason there, Martin. This is the sort of stuff we should be seeing on our. I mean, this guy has incredible credentials, really. He's director of policy and advisory staff to Rudolf Scharping, who was a German Minister of Defense, chief of staff to the federal forces of the German armed forces, the chairman of the NATO military committee until 2005. I mean, he's top guy in Germany, but we're not hearing anything from him at all, are we?
He's Bundeswehr, so he's military, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, that is a comprehensive
general. He's a general.
That's a comprehensive professional military briefing, which no doubt. I mean, there was an admiral who was the head of the navy, the German navy, and he came out with saying, "Well, Crimea is Russian. We've just got to accept that." So he then was forced out. So what you've got is numbskulls like Keir Starmer who think that what we really need to do is go to war with Russia. Then you've got somebody who used to head up the German armed forces saying this is all stupid.
And what he's saying essentially here is that as the Ukrainian army has collapsed, so there are all sorts of other things going on in order to try and keep the war going and actually even extend it, including talking about having a no-fly zone, which would bring the Russian jets directly into conflict with NATO.
Yes, and I think the other thing that's obvious, I mean, I think all of these drone attacks and the so-called overflight, you know, the Russian plane supposedly overflew Estonian airspace, that's because the Estonians have squeezed out their sea lane. Yeah, there's actually a border in the Baltic Sea which is not, nobody controls it, yeah? I mean, Craig Murray will know about this, Law of the Sea. There has to be a non-control. If you've got, you know, two, like Finland and Estonia and Russia, they're all on top of each other. So there has to be a neutral...
An international lane.
An international lane. So this plane was in the international lane, but the Estonians are claiming the Estonians are claiming that because they've extended their net, what they're trying to do is provoke the Russians into a fight so that they can
and
then
they
turn around
lying,
to the Americans.
Lying through their teeth.
And they're
the
also probably behind all of this attacks. Now, in actual fact, people who carry out drone attacks on aircrafts, airfields and so on, that's a criminal offence. Now, if the BND, for example, are involved in that, and we've got very good reason to think they are, the Danish secret services are probably involved in the attack on their
own. BND is the German
secret service. Now, if they're doing that, that's criminal. And, of course, it's criminal.
Well, they're above the law, these people.
Ah, well, maybe we need to have a bit of a Nuremberg for these people. What about it? You've got away with this stuff for years. Now, it's pretty obvious to anybody who's objectively looking at this, and that includes all the rest of the world, you know, in India, Brazil, all around the world, that you are, in fact, creating these problems. The massacre in the Maidan Square in 2014 was carried out by a NATO death squad. We know, because there was a court case in Kiev in 2017 where the Burkut riot police were exonerated, and it became clear that it had been carried out by a NATO death squad run by a US officer called Boyenga.
At the United Nations, Donald Trump has been saying, well, if the Russians do this again, we should shoot their jets down.
Well, in that case, we're all potentially going to die before Christmas, aren't we? Because the danger here is we end up with a nuclear war by accident, as the German commander-in-chief just
Trump
said.
Trump is going to stop this war in 24 hours. He now seems to be adding fuel to the flames.
I'm not one of those people that ever trusted Donald Trump at all. And don't forget, he didn't get 50% of the vote in any other country that had been a runoff, and he wouldn't even be the president.
Well, he might be, yeah.
No, well, he might, but he might not. So the idea that, I mean, ultimately, when you've got a non-democratic structure like our feudal system here with its first-past-the-post, and the US with its two-party, one-party system, first-past-the-post, it's not necessarily a democratic country, and you don't necessarily have to recognise the leadership. Putin, on the other hand, has got 80% support, and it's a proportional system in Russia.
And he's not recognised. He's a dictator.
That's right. Unlike Keir Starmer, he only got 33% of the vote at the last election, but he got a majority of 200.
Well, that's democracy for you.
No, it's Britain
It's democracy for you, because whoever's a leader very rarely gets a majority, actually.
No, in other countries they do.
They don't.
The Irish presidential election is about to take place.
It's the leader of the party with the largest slice of the vote that's normally made.
Yeah, the largest slice of the vote, not the largest number of seats in a first-past-the-post setup.
No, I agree.
There's about to be an election in November in Ireland. There are three candidates. One Fianna Gael, one Fianna Fáil, and one left-wing candidate. And
why not Sinn Féin one?
Sinn Féin are supporting the left.
Why?
Because...
They
don't want to divide the vote. That's right. Because you've got to put them in order. One, two, three. Okay? Now, if Sinn Féin stood as well, that means that the Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil
either Fianna Gael or Fianna Fáil are left-wing, aren't they?
No. They're the right-wing parties. Two right-wing parties, yeah.
Like the Labour Party and Tory Party in Britain?
Well, like the Democratic Party and Republican Party in the United States, a one-party, two-party system.
Don't you get it?
Yes, I do. Of course, the first past the post means that you can shut everybody out.
Anyway, one of the other interesting characters who popped up at New York at the UN, not the Palestinians, they had to be beamed in by Zoom or something, because they're not allowed into New York by Trump, is Jalani from Syria.
Oh, yes, the Al-Qaeda chap that we put in power with our taxes, so folks. Tommy Robinson know that we paid our taxes to put Al-Qaeda power in Syria? That's what I pay my...
I'm not sure if Nigel Farage knows or cares either.
No.
But the point is, if you look at the YouTube channel for the UN, it's quite entertaining, really. You've got little flags by each of the people. And you can look along and you think, well, that one's a robot. He's controlled. He's a puppet. Oh, my goodness, is that someone from Burkina Faso? Maybe he's his own person. And he's actually saying what he really thinks. Almost all of the shenanigans at the UN, it seems to me now, is by puppets who just read out a script. And here's Jalani, who's one of them. He's the Al-Qaeda guy who's replaced President Assad.
From the very moment the former regime fell, we set out a clear strategic policy built upon three pillars: balanced diplomacy, security, stability, and economic development. We filled the power vacuum called for an inclusive national dialogue and announced a government of competence. We strengthened the principle of participation and established a national commission for transitional justice and another for the missing, ensuring justice and fairness. We are now proceeding toward electing representatives of the people in the Legislative Council. We restructured civil and military institutions, dissolving all previous formations.
Well, what's happened with him? I've seen a picture this week of him with his trimmed beard and Zelensky with his trimmed beard, and they look exactly the same. They look similar, yeah? They're both puppets.
Maybe it's the same MI6 person doing their...
Well, it's Jonathan Powell, who used to be Tony Blair's chief of staff. He's behind this particular...
And have they
decided
that this
look... And we've been supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria for years and years and years. And, of course, they've been killing loads and loads of Druze, loads and loads of Christians. They bombed the Christian church. We were talking about Christianity earlier. The Christians in Damascus are being bombed by and killed by the new regime. Yeah? But that's okay, because they're on our side... And
in the middle of all of this, we've heard this week also about Sarkozy, the former president of France, going to prison, which is rather bizarre. Apparently, he's taken some bribes and some, you know. Anyway, what do you make of that?
Well, the bribes he's supposed to have taken are from Gaddafi. Yeah.
But there's nobody left to give any evidence from that.
Well, anyway, the point is that he was corrupt, as many people are. Sarkozy was taking money from
all sorts of
people.
He didn't actually get any money from
him. No, he didn't.
They were just thinking about it.
Well, yes, but I mean, they approached them and said, "Can you give us the money?" And that's what he's been convicted of.
So if I approach you and ask you to give me money, is that a crime?
Well, in electoral law in France, it's a crime. You're not supposed to go and, you're not supposed to go and get money from foreigners for your election in France, okay? So that, I presume that's what the bottom line is. Although, of course, you know, Elon Musk is going to fund Tommy Robinson to any kind of money,
about,
you know.
What about Morgan McSweeney taking money from all these pro-Israelis?
Well, there you go. You see, money doesn't talk, it swears, as Bob Dylan pointed out many years ago.
So what about our own wonderful... I mean, it's actually our foreign secretary, who you would expect either Keir Starmer to be at the UN, or else Yvette Cooper, who's our foreign secretary now, as of a couple of weeks ago. But instead it's David Lammy. He's deputy prime minister. That's why he's there. See what he had to say.
We must all strive for a just and lasting peace in Ukraine, which maintains the integrity of our UN Charter and sees Ukraine emerge from Russia's brutal war as a sovereign, secure and independent nation. President Zelensky has shown his commitment to that peace at every turn, while President Putin savagely rains down ever more missiles and drones on the Ukrainian people. Our message to Ukraine is clear. We will stand with you today, tomorrow, and 100 years from now. We also stand with the people of Sudan because we never forget the values of the UN Charter, of human rights and the pursuit of peace for all men and women. This is a conflict waged against Sudan's civilian population, millions displaced, more facing famine. As I speak, the long-besieged city of El Fasher is falling, its people facing unspeakable atrocities. The people of El Fasher and all across Sudan need the international community to come together to make renewed efforts to achieve peace and allow aid to reach those who desperately need it now. We do all this with our charter as our guide. In the name of the equal rights of men and women and nations large and small. The United Nations and its reform are vital because we need our United Nations more than ever to confront these tragedies and to face our historic opportunity as we are living through a moment of revelation. A new technological frontier is coming into view. we are entering a bracing new era of promise, power, and potential. You know, my friends, to live through the Industrial Revolution was to see the first iron bridges that mankind had made, the first railways, the first smokestacks. And to live today through the technological revolution as we are, it is to witness the coming of the internet, the spread of smartphones, and now the dawn of super powerful AI. This is a lightning strike of change, a technological revolution which our leading scientists think could only be compared to the Industrial Revolution, compressed into a decade. This is a moment of truth for us, our institutions, and our ability to work together. And I believe we must act. I see promise on this technological frontier. AI is the most powerful new lever we have to advance the Charter's vision of social progress, better standards of life. This is why it is at the very heart of my own country's growth plan. I believe that by embracing artificial intelligence, we can all build better businesses. We can better fight crime. Look, for example, at dirty money. By spotting fraud in real time, we can crack down on illicit finance, a fight we will lead at a UK-hosted summit next year. And AI is not hypothetically making lives better. It is already saving them. At Imperial College, a new AI stethoscope detects major heart conditions in seconds. In our National Health Service, AI mammogram trials double the speed of diagnosis. And AI research tools are unlocking new drug combos to fight cancer. On the horizon, the promise of fusion power, powering limitless servers through quantum computing, enabling ever stronger AI, could unleash ever more advanced biotech. This is the defining opportunity of our generation, and we must run towards it with hope.
So there's David Lammy, the ex-Foreign Secretary, now Deputy Prime Minister, speaking at the UN a couple of days ago, or maybe yesterday, actually. So he's talking about this great opportunity of AI. Now, a lot of people are scratching their heads and saying, what great opportunity? Loads of people getting the sack and decisions being made by a computer rather than a human being.
I think the real problem with AI is it's a bubble. Just like the railways, he mentioned the railways there. What happened with the railways in the end is that people bought railway shares because it became, you know, it was just a kind of, everybody bought railway shares because that was the way to make money. Because they just presumed, you know, first of all, it had been canals, and then people lost a load of money who'd invested in canals because the railways then came along and took the canals business. Then people invested in railways, and there was a crash of the railway shares. Yeah. Which then led to a recession. AI has no AI company in the West has made any serious profits at all. Yeah. What they're doing is they're hyping what they're doing. And of course, as long as the bubble is expanding, you are rational to carry on buying into it because you can make money that way. But it's all basically speculative gains. It's actually the rentier classes using their money to pop the bubble up. And of course, if you get out in time, you can make a fortune. Yeah. But of course, it's not going to work, just like the dot-com bubble didn't work. Alex Craner, if we had him on here now, he's a hedge fund manager, as you know, he will be saying exactly what I'm saying. At some point, this bubble is going to burst. And of course, the Chinese have got their own version of AI, which is, you know, a fraction of the price. So that's one of the things that could actually be the pin that burst the bubble. And then, of course, the whole of the Western economy will go down the drain. The banks will collapse. And then we're all going to be on the street, Tony.
Well, I don't know about the banks collapsing. I think that they're just sitting there dragging all the wealth in.
Yes, but that destroys the productive part of the economy.
Well, they don't really care if they own everything. What do you make of Tulsi Gabbard and how she's been getting on? Because I've got a clip now from her talking about COVID recently and about the origins of it. Let's have a listen to the clip and then you can see what you make of it.
The thing that we are working with Jay Bhattacharya, the new NIH director on, with, as well as Secretary Kennedy, is looking at the gain of function research that in the case of the Wuhan lab, as well as many others around, many of these other bio labs around the world, was actually U.S. funded and leads to this dangerous kind of research that in many examples has resulted in either a pandemic or some other major health crisis.
Well, let me ask you specifically, because we already know that EcoHealth Alliance was partnering with this Wuhan lab to create, to do gain-of-function research.
That's right.
We just have never been able to have somebody say, and it was that exact experiment that led to this COVID bug. But have we gotten there? What's the new thing that you're digging in on?
We are working on that with Jay Bhattacharya and look forward to being able to share that, hopefully very soon.
Okay.
That specific
link.
Correct. Between the gain of function research and what we saw with COVID-19.
I mean, that would be extraordinary because just so the audience knows, if that's true, if it was Peter Daszak's research with the Wuhan so-called bat lady that caused this pandemic, then we did fund it. Then Anthony Fauci helped fund the pandemic.
The thing that he denied over and over and over to Senator Rand Paul's questioning.
That's right, under oath.
Under oath, exactly. So is it any wonder that he sought a preemptive pardon for anything during a certain period of time by President Biden before he left office?
And then strong-armed and smeared people like Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, anybody who came out and said, I don't know if that's natural. This actually smacks of lab.
And the reason why this is so important is not just what happened in the past. It's because this gain-of-function research is happening in biolabs around the world. I got attacked, and I think you saw this. We've probably talked about it on your show before when I warned against U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine when the Russia-Ukraine war kicked off for this very reason. Who knows what kinds of pathogens are in these labs? And if released, could create another COVID-like pandemic. And for that, I was called a Russian asset. You're trumpeting Putin's talking points, all of this nonsense, simply for speaking the truth and stating facts that, by the way, are still on U.S. Embassy Ukraine's website today about how the U.S. has funded these biolabs in Ukraine. But in order to, my point is, in order to prevent another COVID-like pandemic or another major health incident that could affect us in the world, we have to end this gain-of-function research and provide the evidence that shows exactly why and how it's in our best interest, the American people's best interest, to bring about an end to it.
Wow, that's Tulsi Gabbard basically saying, Martin, that Fauci, EcoHealth Alliance, Peter Daszak, Wuhan Lab created COVID-19. Then she is not just any old person. She's now Director of National Intelligence in charge of things like the National Security Agency in America.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that this stuff is coming out, and obviously she's interested in bringing it out. But as she points out, they had labs in the Ukraine, they had labs in Georgia, because Diliana Gatasheva, the Bulgarian journalist, uncovered all this years ago. And of course, the real point is not that they're funding this gain-of-function research and there was a terrible accident and then there was a pandemic. It was deliberately released in China just at the moment it was released, because it's a war-fighting strategy. The Pentagon, the deep state in the US deliberately created COVID and deliberately released it. That's what Kirillov, who was the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, General Kirillov, was saying. He was talking to the United Nations Security Council. We think that this has been deliberately created and deliberately released. But of course, MI6 assassinated him.
But my point is that there seems to be an amazing tug of war going on in the United States, where lots of people, you know, part of the establishment, RFK Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, etc., etc. Donald Trump is kind of going off on his own somewhere. But there seems to be an attempt to deal with this and an admission, wow, COVID was due to us. And so that certainly is a positive thing, isn't it?
Jeffrey Sachs, of course, was put in charge by the Lancet of investigating the origins of COVID, and he employed Dashak as his guide to go.
Where is Dashak now? Has anyone felt his collar?
Well, no, they haven't. Don't forget what the problem with what's going to.
He was a Brit, by the way.
Yes, of course he was. That's right. I think it's good that this stuff is coming out. But it's like the Epstein stuff is coming out. But the obvious thing to point out about the Epstein stuff, he was working for Mossad. And what the end result of that is genocide. And anybody who supports is a racist.
Less about, he's dead. It's less about Epstein, much more about Ghislaine Maxwell. Well, she's still around, isn't she?
Well, she is, but of course the whole thing is...
She was the finder. She was finding all these kids.
Yes, but the point I'm trying to make is that the deep state in the US is utterly criminal. Yeah. Just think of all the disruption and death caused by COVID, deliberately created and deliberately
look,
released.
Martin, you see, you're being too negative there, because people like Tulsi Gabbard and Trump have removed loads of people who, for example, were involved in the Steele dossier and using that. So there is a purge, it seems to me, going on within the US deep state at the moment. Maybe it's going to change the direction of the nation. Certainly Trump is not, you know, as an individual. What do you think of that? I mean, they're talking about, by the way, this week, I don't know if you saw this and heard it, but there's this is just a rumour, a big meeting of loads of people to do with the military at the moment.
All
the
generals
States.
And all the admirals have been called to Florida to meet with Pete Hegseth because there's some big, it's never happened before, and it's pretty silly, really, because what are you going to do when you've got them all in the room? The US state... and the US economy and the global economy dominated by the Western rentier classes and the deep state is in deep crisis. That's why we're going to have a third world war. We've just got to win it.
One of the big problems is you've got people like Tulsi Gabbard and RFK Jr. around, maybe. Anyway, let's have a listen, because I haven't seen you.
Problems for them, not for us. Do you see what I mean? They are a problem because they're in there. Look at that German general. Yeah, he should still be in charge of the German army, shouldn't he?
Well, he should be put back in charge.
Yes, there we are.
So these debates are obviously happening with it, but not in the press. We like to try and probe them a little bit here. Well, the death of Charlie Kirk, that happened since we were last live, Martin. The RFK Jr., there was a memorial service for him this week, and RFK Jr., we were just hearing about there, who's now the health secretary, had this to say. I mean, Trump waited till the end. He's obviously using it as a sort of popularity election thing. But there were some interesting characters there. Apparently Tucker Carlson was there too. I'll put the memorial, I think it's about 3 hours or so, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to Charlie Kirk in the assassination. But here is what RFK Jr. had to say at that memorial.
Charlie's overarching passion was his Christianity and his devotion to his God. He believed what St. Francis taught us almost 1,000 years ago, that we should strive to live our lives in perfect imitation of Christ. That we should turn every day and every moment and every interaction into a prayer. And Charlie understood the great paradox that it's only by surrender to God that God's power can flow into our lives and make us effective human beings. Christ died at 33 years old, but he changed the trajectory of history. Charlie died at 31 years old, but because he had surrendered, he also now has changed the trajectory of history. Charlie's other passion was free speech. He understood that the free flow of information was the soil, the water, the sunlight for democracy. He understood democracy's great advantage was that our policies were formed by ideas that had triumphed in a marketplace of debate and conversation. He thought that conversation was the only way to heal our country. And this was particularly important during a technological age when we are all hooked into social algorithms that are hacked into the reptilian cores of our brain and amplify our impulses for tribalism and for division. He felt that the only way to overcome that biological impulse was with a spiritual fire and with developing community. And the only way to develop community was through conversation. And so he always gave the biggest microphone to the people who were most passionately aligned against him, because he believed that we need to talk to each other and that we needed to be able to say what we mean without saying it mean. A few years ago, my brother David died, and I asked my mother, does the hole that they leave in you when they die, does it ever get any smaller? And she said to me, it never gets any smaller. And our job is to grow ourselves bigger around the whole. And we do that by taking the best qualities, the best, most admirable character traits of the person that died, and integrate them with restraint, with discipline, with practice into our own character. And in doing that, we make ourselves larger and the whole gets proportionally smaller. But we also give a kind of immortality to the person who left us, because their work continues through us. A couple of days ago, my granddaughter left for college in Europe. Her mother noticed that she packed a Bible. When her mother asked her why she made that choice, she said, I want to live more like Charlie. And it's... In one of my first conversations with Charlie in July of 2021, we were talking about the risks that all of us take when we challenge entrenched interests, the physical risk. And he asked me if I was scared of dying. And I said to him, there's a lot worse things than death. And one of those things is if we lost our constitutional rights in this country and that our children were raised as slaves. And... I said to Charlie, I said, sometimes the best consolation we can hope for is that we get to die with our boots on. Well, Charlie died with his boots on, and he died to make sure that we didn't have to undergo those fates that are worse than death. Oh, let's remember Charlie. He was, for those of us who were friends with Charlie, we don't need any more evidence of the love of God, because the evidence, the friendship, is the best evidence that God loves us all. Thank you, and God bless you.
So that's RFK Jr. speaking at the Charlie Kirk Memorial. What did you make of the murder, Martin? Anything interesting about the forensics of it, who's behind it, etc.?
Well, I've obviously been looking into all of this, and I, without going into too much detail, I'll just say I don't believe anything that the Western US media says about anything. All of these events for years have been deep state events. And, of course, our immediate suspicion is this is a deep state event. Now, of course, what was happening recently is that Charlie Kirk was starting to turn around to the Israelis and say, I don't want your money, I want to speak against you. So they've definitely got a motive. They've got the means.
I think the thing is that he'd been being funded by the Israel lobby for many years.
That's right.
And when that happens, the people who are funding you think they own you.
Indeed, they do. And if you look at the actual forensics of it, the guy who's supposed to carry out the shot, and he looks like a patsy to me, a bit like Lee Harvey Oswald. Yeah? Just like Sirhan Sirhan, who's still in prison for supposedly murdering RFK Jr.'s father. But he's still in prison, and RFK Jr. himself knows that Sirhan Sirhan didn't kill his father. It was the Israelis who killed his father. It was the Israelis who killed JFK. And guess what? I suspect the Israelis killed Charlie Kirk, because in actual fact, they then... Did you see Netanyahu immediately came out and said, I didn't kill Charlie Kirk? Scott Ritter picked up on that. Why would you say that? It's because you're a prime suspect, matey, because you kill loads of people, don't you? Because you are, in fact, a monster.
There's quite a bit in the memorial from Charlie Kirk himself, but I think it is a bit irritating when you hear people just talking about him. Not that RFK did a bad job, he did a brilliant job. But here's Charlie himself.
Please explain to everyone out here what Jesus stood for, and especially the qualities of love, how to love your neighbor even if they don't agree with you.
That's a beautiful question. Yeah. So John 8, if I'm drawing from memory correctly, best embodies both Christ's mercy and love, but also his commitment to truth. And sometimes in the modern gospel, we overemphasize the grace and we underemphasize the truth.
Yeah.
And so we are far too willing to say, hey, Jesus loves everybody, but we don't get to the second part of the conversation that says Jesus doesn't want you to live in sin. So this is, in John 8, it's best embodied, right? Almost every Christian in this audience will be able to tell you the first part of this, which is a bunch of Sadducees and Pharisees who are standing around with rocks, and they're about to stone the prostitute woman. And Jesus comes up and says, let the first among you without sin cast the first stone. And everyone starts dropping the rocks. But what comes next shows that Christ is not just grace-focused, he's simultaneously truth-focused. He goes up to the woman who had a career in selling herself for sex and said, sin no more. Now, imagine today how much trouble you would get in if you would go up to somebody and say, stop sinning. You're being too judgmental. No, you're actually being Christ-like. So Jesus stood. He was 100% grace and truth. And that tension is very hard in a modern world because we want to overemphasize grace when in reality Christ loves us too much to have us continue to live in sin. He wants us to try to elevate our actions to glorify God in all that we do.
So that's Charlie Kirk's attitude to the Bible. He is framed as a right-wing, he was a right-wing activist. Actually, it seems to me he was more of a Christian leader and somebody who was very successful in winning people over to Donald Trump's cause. But that starts to upset the Israel lobby when he's starting to push away all this stuff to do with Christian Zionism. So he's saying, actually, no, what the Israelis are doing is wrong. So once he starts to do that, he suddenly becomes a bit of a problem, doesn't he?
Yes, and also just from a biblical point of view, she wasn't a prostitute, she was taken in adultery. So he's just got that wrong, Bible studies. I mean, I went to Sunday school, she wasn't a prostitute, okay? Nor was Mary Magdalene, actually, that was a medieval thing. So in other words, what you've got is people who talk about being Christians, blah, 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 and they haven't even read the Bible properly.
But yes, well, maybe they have.
Maybe they haven't.
Well, maybe you haven't.
Well, maybe he hasn't, okay?
Anyway, the point is about sin, isn't it? Do you think sin matters anymore?
Yes, of course. And Netanyahu's a very sinful guy, and I actually think he should probably be executed. Yep. What about that?
Okay, well, anyway, that's a Christian perspective, quite possibly, and even a Jewish perspective about Netanyahu's execution.
Well, some people, proper Christians, Tony, don't believe in killing anybody ever. Total pacifist. Well, I'm not one of those.
There are also
a proper Christian.
Other spiritual beliefs out there, opposing spiritual beliefs.
Different ones.
There was a fantastic program on the other night called The Legend of the Witches from 1970, which is written and directed by Malcolm Lee. So let's wind up tonight by having a clip from there, which talks a bit about the beliefs of witches.
In the beginning was the moon, Diana. Sad, silent, alone she wandered. The waves, her sighs and tears of solitude. She searched everywhere for a companion, but found only reflections of herself. Lonely, Diana desired a lover. That desire became the dawn, and from the dawn came the sun, Lucifer, the god of light. The moon, Diana, and the sun, Lucifer, loved each other. The fruit of this love were the sky and the earth, water and fire, forests and plants, birds fishes, and animals. This is the witch's legend of creation. Diana and Lucifer also created man. They gave him the world and taught him to hunt, kill, and be content that he might better worship them. To these powerful gods, man erected huge monuments and temples of stone. Thousands of them, aligned along the paths of their gods across the sky. To the gods, for the chiefs, great warriors, poets, musicians, and artists, a stone was raised. A stone which has given them greater immortality than their gods. Many of these groups of stones, like Stonehenge, were complex observatories predicting what once were thought the unpredictable, fickle wandering of their gods. Man, now able to predict, soon sought to control the gods. They entrusted this control to priests. To choose these priests, the witches, a name which comes from the Anglo-Saxon word wicca, meaning wise, hold a severe initiation ceremony. Those already initiated perform a ritual called drawing down of the moon. Since the moon is a woman, Diana, the chief of the witches is a priestess. This ceremony calls down and concentrates Diana's power in this priestess, and through her, the circle and those dancing in it. Away from the circle, the initiate, blindfolded, is prepared for the ordeals which he must undergo before becoming a witch.
Michael.
His name is called, and he must follow, regardless of where he is asked to go or what he is asked to do. This voice both serves as a guide, and although he does not know it,
Michael,
to protect him from death. On his way to the circle, the initiate is to be made aware, through his own experience, of the four elements which make up the universe. Water,
Michael,
air, earth, and fire.
So, interesting. The rituals are very similar to those of Freemasonry from witchcraft. That is an excerpt from, or the opening, actually, of this documentary, which I think is about an hour and a half long altogether, called Legend of the Witches, written and directed by Malcolm Lee back in 1970. And it's almost as if there's a sort of, it's a sort of specialist branch of witchcraft, Freemasonry, which is specifically focused around Solomon's Temple. So I put up a link on this week's show page, a picture actually, of the comparison between the Masonic square and compasses symbol with a V pointing up and on top of a V pointing down, right next to the Star of David from the Israeli flag. And of course, if you just put two lines across, it's exactly the same symbol. And the question is, are there connections? Of course, it's highly likely that, of course, yes, there are. And then there's also the ritual for the third degree of Freemasonry, which is all about the building or rebuilding of Solomon's Temple by the Phoenician Hiram Abiff. So really, Solomon's as a central figure in Freemasonry is fascinating, because he was, although he was a wonderful king back in the Old Testament, the creation of his temple really shows a leaning over to the Phoenicians and a falling away from God. So isn't it funny that they make out that they're somehow godlike, but then they follow this He was a failed king, essentially, that went over to all sorts of debauchery. Sid Solomon, that's their hero. And it's all there in Freemasonry. And, of course, very similar to that Israeli Star of David flag. So that will be up on our show page, don't worry, at thisweek.org.uk later on. Well, it's there now, actually. And I'll put the full version of that documentary, so you can have a good old listen to that. I'll put a link up to the film of it as well, which is it's extremely difficult to find. I found one copy of it on the internet that was actually possible to download, so I grabbed it. It's a war on God, but God is going to win. Time to sign off now. So thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and to our guests, who were number one was Chris Busby, the independent nuclear not engineer exactly, what is he? He's a nuclear scientist. And also to Marianne Birkby from Radiation Free Lakeland this week. All the full versions of many of those interviews, including the Charlie Kirk thing too, will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And also thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download the MP3s and listen in the car or any way you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. You can get those MP3s via just an ordinary download, or you can get them on the app, which allows you to download them onto your phone so you can listen easily, even if you're not connected up to the internet, which the BBC don't do that, do they? No. Do please send me interviews and story tips on Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show page. Occasionally I get some interesting bits and bobs people post up on there. Quite a lot of spam, but that all gets zapped. So you can also get the podcast, full length interviews, story links, and the comment page there. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, and if you can afford it too, do please donate. Thanks to everyone who has done, or set up a small monthly sub at thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays, 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. We have been streaming live at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, and of course on talkradio.org.uk. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down. We'll be right back.
yours. Sometimes it seems to me as if I'm just being used. Cause then we gotta try and shake off this creeping malaise. If I don't stand my own ground, how can I find my way out?
Check.